TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady right here on NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia, where, yes, you can visit the Hybrid State Park. You can peruse the wares at Greenfront Furniture, and you can even say hi to us on Main Street. Got a great show for you this afternoon. Coming up about 20 minutes from now, Rob O'Donnell is going to be with us from Brothers Before Others. We'll talk about story out of USA Today on what happened to the crime rate in Baltimore over the last few years since the death of Freddie Gray and the riots that ensued, and Baltimore police not making as many contacts on their own as they did before those riots began, before the Obama Justice Department stepped in, before you had individuals of the Baltimore Police Department get convicted, part of their other gun unit. You know, the police force in Baltimore, you've seen the incredible turnover the last 4 years. I think you've had a commissioner about once every 9 months. They've announced a new commissioner. There's a lot of stuff going on in Baltimore. But one of the things that is interesting, you know, the USA Today story frames this as police stopped noticing crime after Freddie's Gray death. And it's not really the case. That's actually not even what the story alleges, because the response to calls initiated by citizens from Baltimore police was obviously still there. It's not like response time dropped. But there was this sense of, okay, if I go out and I initiate an arrest, is the city going to have my back, both in terms of the elected officials or the community? What am I allowed to do? What am I not allowed to do? And so I'll quote, play it safe. I'll respond to these calls, but you know what? I'm going to keep my eyes forward as I'm driving down the street. We'll talk about this with Rob O'Donnell later in the hour. Seton Motley from Less Government joins us later in the hour as well. Amazon's no-profit model, he says, bleed competitors to death and then do exactly what they did. Also, now, what does it have to do with Less Government? We'll find out from Seton Motley. Next hour, Gabby Franco of Tips and Tactics. Speaking of bleeding folks to death, down in Venezuela, thieves are actually plundering headstones. Yeah. Because, I mean, basically anything of value, anything that you can use to sell to get precious bolivars to buy food for your family, you're now doing in Venezuela because the economy has largely collapsed there in that socialist paradise. I know. It's not real socialism because real socialism has never been tried. Mm-mm. It's going to be the democratic socialists who do it. Can't even get out of their parents' basement for the most part. But they're gonna do it, Cameron. And skeptics like you, you're gonna pay the price first. Also coming up in hour three, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart will join us. Kurt Schlichter of Town Hall, who says that the liberals are super sad about the Supreme Court. Good, he says. We'll also talk about a court case that Kurt was involved with, attorney of record for Ben Shapiro, dealing with the clock boy story from a couple of years ago. I mean, I don't know if you remember that, 15 minutes. But yes, Kurt was actually in court earlier this week, so we'll chat with Kurt about that. But I want to update a big story from yesterday out of New York's 21st Congressional District. Tedra Cobb, the Democrat candidate there in the 21st, caught on tape telling gun control activists that, you know, I support a gun ban. In fact, I just had this conversation the other day. Well, heck, I don't want to put words in her mouth. First, to set this up, a couple of days ago out on Twitter, the local newspaper, the Post Star, tweets this out, that Tedra Cobb, the Democrat running in New York's 21st Congressional District, has taken the paper's No Lies pledge. And Tedra Cobb retweets this, responding, I have run my campaign with honesty and integrity from the very beginning. That won't change now. So a little bit of foreshadowing. Take note that the Post Star was really, really happy to talk about this candidate taking the No Lies pledge. Okay, so that was back on July the 8th. And then yesterday, actually 2 days ago, Tuesday afternoon, Steve Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon breaks this story with audio and video of this candidate, Tedra Cobb, telling gun control activists there in the district that she's actually not telling voters what she really thinks about banning semi-automatic firearms because it will cost her the election. Take a look and listen.
When I was at this thing today, the first table I was at, a woman said, how do you feel about assault rifles? And I said, they should be banned. And I said, you know, then people were getting up to go to go get their lunch. It was a buffet. Yeah. I just said to her, I want you to know, Cindy, I cannot say that. And she said, well, I want you to. And I said, I won't win.
Exactly. It's like, there's things you want to say.
I said, moms to me. Yeah, moms says. And Trisha Plou said, do not say that you want an assault rifle ban because you will not win.
Before we had our walk-up, we met with moms to ban action.
All right, so you will not win. If I say this, I'm not going to win. Moms ban action. So I won't win. Now, okay, so since then, there have been a couple of developments. Yesterday afternoon, we told you the Post Star finally covered this story late afternoon, and it was kind of an exculpatory story, noting, you know, she never actually said that she supported or didn't support a gun ban. She just kind of dodged the issue. So was she really lying? Was she really? Because she never really answered the, even when she was asked directly, she never actually told people what she thought. So it's just that she wasn't really lying. She was just hiding what she thought from the voters. Tedra Cobb came out with a statement issued to one of the local papers there, not Steve Gutowski for some weird reason, in which she actually sidestepped the issue altogether, saying that she was honest in her conversation with these students about what's wrong with Washington, how we can't really get things done. And again, never once actually acknowledged what she said to those students, that, yeah, I support this gun ban, but I can't say it because if I do, I'll lose the election. So the Post Star today comes out with an editorial. And Cameron, you and I had talked about this yesterday, wondering, would the Post Star have an editorial? So they do.
And they even responded to you on Twitter, which I thought was interesting. They know we're watching.
I haven't even seen that yet.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yesterday you asked them any update to the story, and about an hour ago they said, visit poststar.com for your reading pleasure. And I'll retweet this at Cam and Cummings so people can read along.
Oh, I derived a lot of pleasure from reading this, let me tell you. You're gonna hear every word. Yeah, because this is glorious. So yesterday we've been talking about this. Okay, will they write an editorial? Because my theory was that the Post Star probably wants to endorse Tedra Cobb. That's my theory. That the Post Star wants to endorse Tedra Cobb, does not want to endorse Elise Stefanik, who's the incumbent, who's a Republican in this district. And we had talked about playing Karnak. I was going to write down my bullet points. I'll be honest, I didn't do that. I would have been wrong. I would have been wrong. Because there is an editorial today involving the No Lies Pledge, but it has nothing to do with Tedra Cobb. It has nothing to do with the Democrat who was caught on tape saying, I can't tell the voters what I really think about a gun ban because then I won't get elected. No. The editors of the Post Star run an editorial today. Representative Stefanik, the people deserve the truth. Representative Stefanik, the people deserve the truth. Now, keep in mind, again, it was Tedra Cobb who was accused of not being honest with the voters, but this is what the Post Star paper chose to go with. This, by the way, is why the media and their credibility is in the toilet right now. So I'm going to read every word of this editorial to you. When we requested each candidate, and again, just keep in mind what you've heard over the past couple of minutes, this is what the paper came out with today. When we requested each candidate in the 21st Congressional District not lie during the ensuing campaign, we did it out of desperation. We chose our words carefully, trying not to inflame or antagonize. We aimed for the moral high ground by making one simple request. We asked them not to lie. We wanted to make this easy. We wanted to make the decision as painless as possible for political parties that treat elections as wars. This should have been a no-brainer. Surely this basic appeal to the morality of the candidates, to their basic sense of right and wrong, would be something all could agree upon. Now, up to that point, you might think the next paragraph is going to say, and then we learned about Tedra Cobb, right? Well, here's what you get instead.
Congressional candidate Tedra Cobb responded last Thursday to the Sunday editorial. Communicating through a letter to the editor, Cobb wrote that this was, quote, an easy commitment for me to make. She even challenged our reporters and editors at the newspaper to hold her and the incumbent, Elise Stefanik, quote, accountable to the promise of conducting an honest campaign. Now, again, this would be a perfect pivot point to then note Cobb's own failures, right? No, that's not what you get. Here's what you get instead. Sadly, our sitting congresswoman did not contact our editorial board at all. When a Post-Star reporter asked to talk to her about whether she would commit to not lying in the campaign, he was told that the congresswoman was not available. That is unfortunate, but not surprising for an incumbent politician and another indication of how far our political process has fallen. Remember a few paragraphs ago when the Post-Star editorial board was trying to claim moral high ground? How's that working out for you guys? That was part of the motivation behind this request as well. We wanted to make it clear that this request came out of a sense of desperation. Oh, you're sounding desperate. Out of a sense of desperation we sense in our communities and from our readers, we believe we are all sick of being lied to, of being conned with political speak that is designed to confuse and obfuscate. We are sick of the advertisements that are heavy on emotion and light on facts. We are tired of the personal attacks. All we asked is for both candidates to not lie, and unbelievably, we could not find common ground. You know, again, there's no mention in this editorial of what Tedra Cobb is accused of doing at all. They say, we post an unscientific straw poll on poststar.com last week that goes to the heart of how far we have fallen as a society. Oh, because now society's fault. The poll asked whether Cobb and Stefanik should pledge not to use deceitful tactics during their campaigns. Shockingly, 15% of the respondents were opposed to our request. Is 15% of the community really pro-lying? Is our community, is our moral compass that off kilter? We certainly hope our congresswoman's silence is not indicative of this train of thought. We reach out to her again to say it is not too late. We urge her to join Tedra Cobb in pledging not to lie during the campaign. We urge her to commit to debates in every county of the district. We urge her to imagine a campaign of ideas that debates the solutions to actual problems and recognizes the problems the citizens of the 21st Congressional District face. We know one thing, the people deserve the truth. How can you not agree with that? I'm kind of stunned. I mean, I really am. That's some audacious behavior right there. And again, look, it's a newspaper. They're going to write what they want to write about. And this is what they want to write about. They want to write about how important it is to tell the truth while not holding Tedra Cobb to her pledge. I mean, Cameron, I realize this is the editorial board and this doesn't necessarily reflect on the reporters of this newspaper. But again, given everything that's happened in this community for the last 2 days, is this not the most tone-deaf newspaper editorial that you've ever heard?
If not ever, it's up there. As you read it, I was reading along, and I'm looking at it again, trying to digest this. And it's like I said, we put it at Cam and Company. Everyone who watches and listens to the show should read this because it's really, you think you've seen it all. We're watching a MSM implode on a daily basis with stories that are immediately debunked. I look at NBC News as a huge culprit right now with their stories about Justice Kennedy, and they had to retract and delete tweets. And we're just seeing so much media mismanagement. And this is, sure, it's on a smaller scale, and this will definitely not make the national news, but you could just take the names out and put any name or any city or any congressional district. It doesn't matter. I mean, this is it's staggering that this is in print or on our computer screens.
I mean, it really is. And again, I would love to say that this isn't going to impact the editorial or the news content of this paper. I can't honestly tell you that, because here's the thing. There are some great local reporters out there. There are some great local newspapers out there. That doesn't mean that every reporter out there is great. And it doesn't mean that every local newspaper, every local media outlet is great. There's a lot of crap out there, too. And there are a lot of, and look, this is kind of a dirty little secret in the small town, you know, publishing world. But you get into these small towns and you may be dealing with machine politics. You may be, your newspaper publisher may be intimately involved in businesses, printing businesses with some of the Democratic politicians. They may be, you know, have contracts with some of these individuals. Or they may just be ideologically aligned. Certainly, again, in newspapers, the editorial page is supposed to be sort of independent from the newsroom, but the smaller the scale of the operation, the less likely that is to happen. But since we know that that's the case, I think it's incumbent on those press entities and those individuals working in the press, if they want to have the trust of the community, well, they have to understand that it has to be earned. And it's earned every time they put out a story. It's earned every time they publish a paper. And it can be gained and it can be lost. If you want to lose the trust of your community, it's a really good way to do it. Yes, sir.
Kim, so we were just talking about NBC News, and I'm looking up at the at our monitors here at 2:15 Eastern Time on Thursday. Peter Strzok has they started the hearing again, the huge hearing on Capitol Hill. And this is a tweet that the CPAC Twitter account retweeted that goes to what we were just saying. This is from Ken Delanian, who is his title is Intelligence and National Security Reporter for NBC News, who we were just talking about. And he tweeted earlier in the first half of the Strzok hearing, even when they aren't letting him finish, Peter Strzok is a poised, self-possessed, compelling witness. That's the reporter.
I'm sorry, did you say he was a reporter or a publicist?
I said, right. He's a reporter, not a flack.
Yeah, we can acknowledge this. We can ask them to do better. They're not going to do better. Not because we ask them to do better. They're going to do better when they realize how far they've fallen. That's what's going to happen. And maybe it takes a new generation of journalists coming in who look at what's going on and they say, this is garbage. Or maybe we just get this for another generation and we have to sift through the garbage each and every day to try to find those nuggets of real news out there. Because based on what we're seeing every day in the world around us, the media doesn't really seem all that interested in, you know, navel gazing right now and looking at, back in 2016, after Trump won, it was interesting. They went through this little period of time of how could we get this all wrong, right? And they dispatched reporters out to the hinterlands. Barbara, you go to Montana. Brett, what are you still doing here? I thought we fired everybody named Brett. All right. Brett, you go to Utah. And let's talk to the bumpkins. Let's find out what is it that we missed. And then that window closed and they went back to hating the bumpkins and feeling really good about themselves. Right. And that's just sort of continued and has been amped up, in the, months since. And I don't think we've hit that peak of the self-satisfied media behavior yet. I think it's going to get worse before there's any hope of it getting better. But in the meantime, thankfully, you got outlets like NRA TV and programs like Ham and Company to, you know, try to cut through the clutter and cut through the misinformation and actually call out the media when they try to engage in misinformation campaigns. All right, stick around. We got to take a timeout when we come back. Rob O'Donnell joins us from Brothers Before Others. We'll talk about what's going on in Baltimore, Maryland. So stick around. Just getting started here on this Thursday edition of Cam and Company. Police have arrested a Lafayette man in connection with the shooting of a woman. 32-year-old Craig Valier has been booked now on attempted second-degree murder, domestic abuse, battery, as well as felon in possession of a firearm. The victim of the shooting still in critical condition. Police say the shooting stemmed from a domestic fight. Valier's bond has been set at $50,000 on the weapons charge. He has no bond on the attempted murder and the domestic abuse charge. And this is not the first time that this 32-year-old has been accused of violence against women. Go back a little bit more than a decade ago, 2007, when Craig Valier would have been about 20 or 21. Woman said that he choked and punched her and threatened her with a weapon. The court granted her a protective order, ordered law enforcement to take the woman to Valier's home to retrieve her belongings. Later that year, Valier was charged with domestic violence in connection with the same incident, as well as with possession with intent to distribute cocaine. He was allowed to plead guilty. The domestic violence charge was dropped entirely, and he was allowed to plead guilty to a revised charge of attempted possession with intent to distribute cocaine. See, this is what drives me nuts about the plea bargain system. I'm not an attorney, and I know I'm going to have attorneys and judges write into me and explain to me why I shouldn't be driven nuts by stuff like this, but this drives me crazy. So you got a guy, you catch him, he's got cocaine. He's got enough cocaine, you can charge him with possession with intent to distribute. How does that get pled down to attempted possession with intent? Did he have it? Yes. Well, then he didn't attempt to get it. He successfully got it, didn't he? The mind boggles. So the domestic violence charge is dropped. The drug charge is reduced. He pleads guilty to the reduced charge, and he's sentenced to 7 years in prison, which was immediately suspended. It was suspended, and he was placed on 5 years active probation. So the 7-year prison sentence becomes a 0-year prison sentence. Now, in 2013, his probation was revoked. And KATC says Valier was sent to jail to serve the original sentence, the original sentence being 7 years. And his probation was revoked in 2013. So if he got to serve the original sentence of 7 years, he would have been out in 2020. Instead, he was out the very next year. He was out in 2014 after serving the time required under Louisiana law. So there you go. Sentenced to 7 years in prison. Sentenced to a suspended sentence. Stay out of trouble. You don't have to go do any time behind bars. But if you break your probation, the original sentence is going to be imposed on you. Violates his probation, the original sentence is imposed. But now it's not a 7-year sentence. Now it's a 1-year sentence. And he's out by 2014. 6 months later, according to KATC, Valier was arrested. 3 months after that, he was formally charged with shooting another woman. That'd be in 2014. That'd be 4 years ago. Charged with aggravated assault with a firearm, illegal carrying of a concealed weapon, possession of a firearm in the presence of drugs, attempted possession with intent to distribute cocaine, felon in possession of a firearm, resisting an officer, possession of a firearm in a firearm-free zone, as well as possession of oxycodone. In a plea deal, prosecutors dropped the charges of attempted possession with intent to distribute cocaine, as well as possession of a firearm in the presence of drugs. Valier pleaded guilty to the remainder of the charges, including the shooting, and was sentenced to a total of 8.5 years in prison. That was 4 years ago. So 4 years ago, he gets an 8.5-year prison sentence. None of it was suspended. In fact, under Louisiana law, he was required to serve 85% of the 2-year sentence for the shooting and 35%. That's right, 85% of the 2 years he got for shooting somebody. And he actually got 6.5 years for things like possession of a firearm in the presence of drugs, felon possession of a firearm, possession of oxycodone, but he only had to serve 35% of the 6.5-year sentence that he received. He got credit for time that he had already served while awaiting trial. And while he was behind bars, he also earned a year off his sentence for taking certified treatment and rehabilitative program classes. KATC says these classes, which include topics like anger management, drug treatment, job skills, and education, are offered to inmates in an effort to better prepare them for reentry into society. Now, look, there's nothing wrong with those classes. That's great. In fact, I would say that there are probably a lot of folks who can benefit from those classes. Clearly, Mr. Valier wasn't one of them, since he got out in November of last year, and now he stands accused once again of attempted murder. So what does it take? What does it take to bring a case like this to trial? Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. I am going to be headed down to Bristol, the Bristol Motor Speedway. I may already be a little excited. I may be, you know, already thinking ahead just a little bit here. We've got the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race coming up August 18th, and you can get your tickets now at NRARaceTix.com, T-I-X.com. Make sure that you go ahead and you get your seats early, and if you can, plan on spending a couple of days down there. We're going to head down there this weekend. We're going to give you a taste of what there is to see and do in Bristol, including Headed out to the Bristol Motor Speedway. But honestly, it's going to be a fantastic weekend. We hope that we do get a chance to see you there. Rob O'Donnell with Brothers Before Others is with us on the program right now. Rob, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Cam. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program this afternoon. Saw this story at USA Today, and, you know, despite what I think was a little misleading headline, I think the story itself is actually pretty interesting. So the headline is Baltimore police stopped noticing crime after Freddie Gray's death. A wave of killings followed. And that, to me, makes it sound like Baltimore police just looked the other way, didn't respond to calls, things of that nature. That's not what actually happened. It's not even really what the article asserts here. What the article says is that police stopped seeing fewer drug dealers on street corners. They encountered fewer people who had open arrest warrants. They responded to calls, but they did not go out of their way to go out and make arrests. And honestly, Rob, I mean, I think one of the big questions is, was that of their own accord? Was that coming from the police department, which was, you know, certainly under fire locally as well as nationally? You know, what actually happened in Baltimore after those riots, and even beforehand with the Obama Justice Department coming in, and what has been the effect of on a police force that now is kind of worried, okay, if I actually go out and do my job, am I going to get arrested? Am I going to get prosecuted? Am I going to get turned into a villain?
Yeah, what you're seeing is the transformation from a proactive police force to a reactive police force. And why is that, we're going to ask. Well, police, law enforcement across this nation ask for three things. They ask for the training to do what they do and to protect and serve. They ask for the tools to protect and serve. And they ask for the support to protect and serve. And by support, I mean both the citizens they serve, their coworkers, their supervisors, and their elected officials. And they've lost that. The elected officials in Baltimore specifically, but you can bring up Chicago, you can bring up New York, and everywhere where these crimes are starting to spike, they've basically thrown the police under the bus. They've gone with the rhetoric of the mainstream media that the police are bad, with the prior administration demonizing the police every chance they could have gotten. And it's turned your police into a reactive police force. Yes, they're still going to do their job. Yes, they're still going to answer 911 calls. But that proactive policing that was so vital to this country back in the late 90s and early 90s under the Rudy Giuliani and the Bill Bratton, which was the model for the broken windows theory and the proactive policing, which was the model for the country that reduced crime in the 90 percentiles, reduced homicides to all time low. We've gotten away from that. Why? Because we've let a small percentage, a fraction of a percent, of bad cases get publicized by the media and these politicians and these people with they want to promote their careers by throwing the police under the bus and letting it take a mainstream hold, letting people believe the rhetoric that they're being taught. Is policing in general a perfect profession? Absolutely not. But show me one that is. But we don't throw out a 40,000 acre head of corn field because 12 years went bad. We don't throw a brand new car away because a spark plug went bad. You know, you target those problems, which they have.
Absolutely. And Baltimore, you know, I mean, look, it's got its share of troubles. We talked about the, you know, incredibly high turnover for the police commissioner in Baltimore, where it seems like, you know, every 9 months or so, there's been a new police commissioner. The one resigned back in May, Daryl D'Souza, after federal prosecutors charged him with failing to pay his income taxes. But in Baltimore as well, you know, you did have the it was the one of the gun units there that was involved with apparent corruption. There were, I think, 8 members that were convicted in a corruption scandal this year. Now, as you say, this was actually brought to court. These officers were charged. It's not like they got a pass because they were law enforcement officers. They were brought to justice and they were convicted. But, you know, in Baltimore right now, I mean, the USA Today talked to a retired lieutenant, Victor Gearhart, who said officers no longer put themselves on the firing line. He said these guys aren't stupid. They realize if they do something wrong, they're going to get their heads bit off. There's no feeling that anybody's behind them anymore. And so they're not going to do it. Nobody wants to put their head in the pizza oven when the pizza oven is on. He said that no one ordered him or others to make fewer stops or to take fewer risks. He said, we didn't have to tell them. He said, we just said, these are the facts of the situation. And if you want to risk your career, have at it.
Yeah, and we've let the rhetoric take hold of policing and guide policing rather than the proactive and letting the stats and letting the facts deal with the focus the police efforts. Now you have the racial profiling and the stop, question, frisk. Stop, question, frisk was a vital tool. These are professional police officers that know exactly what they're looking for. They know that such and such a drug dealer usually carries a gun. He belongs to this gang. He has that bandana. He's wearing a winter coat in July, and he's keeping his elbows tight to his chest. You know, securing something there. You know, you stop and question that for somebody and you touch the side and you feel the firearm. These are the tools we've taken away. These are professionals who knew what they were doing. And again, were there people who took advantage of that? And again, this is a small percentage of a percentage that did that. And there's organizations to take care of that. There's internal affairs. There's supervision. There's other officers who say, hey, this isn't right. You know, we got to look into this guy. But to take the small percentage of cases, to take, I noticed that Ferguson was mentioned in this article in USA Today. Ferguson was a fallacy. You know, the hands up, don't shoot was proven time and time again. That whole tragedy was because a criminal acted like a criminal and the police did what the police should do.
Talking with Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others, there was another interesting quote in this USA Today article, Rob, by Peter Moskos, who's a former Baltimore police officer, now with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And he said exactly as you said. He said the cops are being less proactive at the same time that violence is going up. He said cops are doing as requested. And I think that's interesting. He said cops are doing as requested, lessening racial disparity, lessening complaints, lessening police-involved shooting. All those numbers are doing just great right now. And if those are your metrics of success, we're winning. The message has clearly gotten out not to commit unnecessary policing. Now, you know, one of the things that you brought up is that people are now attacking cops in Baltimore because the crime is going up. But as Peter Moskos says, look, these are the metrics that you said you wanted to judge officers by. And as it turns out, if those are the metrics that you're judging officers by, don't be surprised if violent crime starts to skyrocket because you're not going to have a proactive police force.
And I'll fast forward this 10 years. The citizens of Baltimore, the good people of Baltimore, of all demographics, are going to be screaming for the police to do more. They're going to be asking for stop, question, frisk, because it was done. I was there in the late 80s, early 90s in New York City when you had the communities coming out and said, please take our communities back. Please do these things. Now, there comes a point when proactive policing gets crime down to a level where it needs to be reevaluated. It needs to be restructured. You can't continue, you know, a hardline law enforcement presence in these communities once you've dropped that crime, once you've taken it. Proactive policing, the benefit of it is once you take back those community from these criminals, once you reduce that crime, it's easier to maintain it. It's always 10 times harder in anything to gain that back. And all they're doing is brushing these issues under the rug. The politicians are saying, hey, I don't want another riot on my watch. Police chiefs are saying, you know, I don't want that court case that you're probably going to win anyway, but, you know, we'd rather stay away from it. And one of the quotes in this article from the new police commissioner, and I want to get it word for word. We don't want officers going out, grabbing people out of corners, beating them up and putting them in jail. That statement from the current police commissioner when he wants to serve his police department and lead his police department to take that community back is disgusting.
You know, I saw that, Rob, and I was going to ask you actually about that because you're right. First of all, nobody wants that. Right? I mean, that kind of goes without saying. But it kind of sounds like the police commissioner is saying that, you know, boy, I gotta keep an eye on these officers because if I don't put my, thumb down here, that's what they're going to be doing. They're going to be grabbing people, out of the corners, beating them up. You're right. I mean, it's not just a lack of respect for those officers. It's almost a sense of contempt for those officers there in Baltimore. And that's coming from
the police
commissioner.
Absolutely. He's going with the mainstream media and the prior administration saying, hey, if we don't watch these guys, they're going to start beating people up again, when it was a fraction of a fraction percent that might have happened to begin with. You know, we have a justified use of force. Police officers today are afraid to use that. If someone squares up with you and you're trying to make a lawful arrest, we're allowed to use force. We should use force. We have levels of force. You know, we have physical force. We have our batons and mace. We have tasers and our firearm if need be. And more and more police officers, if you look at the statistics, and if you just watch YouTube and then the internet, are getting challenged with these warriors with cell phones who think they can push the envelope, think they can challenge police physically, and nothing's going to happen to them. And police are holding back on what they should be doing and getting injured because of it, because of rhetoric like this chief is putting out there.
Talking to you with Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others. Listen, Rob, I appreciate your time this afternoon, sir. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Enjoy Bristol. I'm sad I'm going to miss it.
I'm sad, too, but we'll talk to you about it. We might be able to just, you know, somehow get you down here for August 18th.
That
Rob O'Donnell
good.
With us here on Cam and Comedy. We also have, you know, well, I was going to tell Rob, he might still be listening, if you can't make it to Bristol, or heck, why not do both? Coming up in September, we have the NRA Carry Guard Expo, and it's not quite in Farmville's backyard. It's a little bit more than an hour away from Farmville, Virginia, at Richmond, Virginia. I am so excited about this. You can find out more information at NRACarryGuardExpo.com, September 14th, 15th, and 16th in Richmond, Virginia. There are going to be hundreds of self-defense seminars. There are going to be all kinds of classes. You will walk out of there so much smarter and so much more prepared than you did when you walked in. And there are going to be some great vendors. It's going to be just an absolutely fantastic time. We were there in Milwaukee for the first Carry Guard Expo last year. And it was a great weekend. We're going to be there this weekend in September as well, September 14th through the 16th, NRA Carry Guard Expo. You can get your tickets now, and we will see you there. I'll even make some restaurant recommendations for you if you're heading into Richmond from out of town. All right, when we come back, Seton Motley from Less Government is going to be with us on the program. We do have much more Cam and Company straight ahead, so stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children. And freedom's safest place.
Citizenry makes for a stronger country, a stronger society, a safer society.
And we prepare for so much that leads up to pulling the trigger. Are you prepared to deal with what happens after?
It's as complete a package as we could possibly have put together. We want to give someone the tools so that they can make good decisions in a very stressful, probably the most stressful situation that they'll ever encounter.
Having the NRA actually put together standardized concealed carry training and putting the resources behind it, you know, says quite a bit.
Everybody involved has that real world experience, has the education, has the understanding.
You know that this training is safe and it will work.
From the tactical, we're ready up.
It's far easier than anyone understands for an innocent person to be convicted of a crime.
We live in a litigious society. You need an attorney that understands what you've gone through, that understands the legal parameters of this situation, and is going to be able to not just adequately defend your rights, but to defend your rights from the tyranny of restrictions that prevent you from being able to defend yourself. Protect yourself. Get Carry Guard.
Call 911. wait for the law enforcement to show up, and then call the emergency hotline on the back of their NRA Carry Guard membership card that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to all NRA Carry Guard members.
When we're talking about something like the NRA, we're talking about the largest civil rights organization in the country.
There is no other entity that has the expertise, the resources, the connections, the philosophy, and the infrastructure.
There is no other organization in the United States of America that can do what NRA has done with Carry Guard. There is no organization that gives you that gold standard protection and assurance.
If I find myself in a position where I had to use my gun to defend my life, I can tell you right now, I'm going to be glad that I had the Carry Guard.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. I'm right here on NRA TV. All right, you know, I feel bad because I know, like, most of the political world is just engrossed in the Peter Schrock testimony right now. We don't have that with you. I did just see a tweet from David Martosko, the Daily Mail, Democratic Representative Steve Cohen from Tennessee, to Peter Schrock right now. Quote, Mr. Schrock, if I could give you a Purple Heart, I would. Fun story real quick before we get to Seed Molly. So my dad's a World War II veteran, signed up when he was a teenager, actually did not finish high school so he could enlist in the Navy. And he doesn't have a Purple Heart, even though his destroyer that he was on was the subject of a kamikaze attack off the coast of Okinawa. And a few years ago, I was actually talking to my dad about this. And because as I was a kid, I remembered my dad being wounded in that attack. As it turns out, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know if I got an old war movie confused, but my dad says, no, he said, it wasn't ever anything serious. He said, when I was going to my battle station, had to go down a ladder, and something happened, and he ended up, like, ripping his finger. I thought there was something with his eyes, but he ended up ripping his finger. Anyway, one of his superiors told him he should put in for a Purple Heart, and my dad said, no. He said, well, we were at, you know, you're going to your battle station. I mean, that actually qualifies as a Purple Heart. You were injured. And my dad said no. His honor would not have allowed him to get a medal for hurting his finger going down a ladder, even if technically he had met the requirements to get a Purple Heart. And that's always just stuck with me since my dad told me about that. So to see Steve Cohen tell Peter Strzok that he deserves a Purple Heart, maybe Representative Cohen needs to actually go back and learn why that medal is actually awarded. All right, well, want to welcome to the program right now my favoritely named public figure besides Elon Musk, Seton Motley from Less Government is with us. Seton, how are you, sir?
Fine, sir. First of all, I want to thank your father for his service. Second of all, I'd like to point out that injury was more serious than all three of John Kerry's Purple Hearts.
Well, yeah.
And third of all, it reminded me of a MASH, not you, but John Kerry reminds me of a MASH line that was really funny from the TV show MASH. Where Frank Burns put in for a Purple Heart, and he goes, I deserve one. It was a shell fragment. He goes, it was an eggshell fragment. What are you talking about? So anyway, thank you very much to your father.
I will pass that along next time I talk to him. Now let's talk about your piece at Less Government, or at Red State right now. Amazon's no-profit model, bleed competitors to death, and then do exactly what they did. So you point out Amazon market cap right now, over $750 billion. Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the history of the world. And you say that their dominance of more and more sectors of the economy are great and growing. And you say the way they do it, quote, by any means necessary. I'm curious. Are you saying this with admiration or admonishment or a little bit of both, Seton?
Admonishment. What they're doing is illegal. I'm probably one of the least appreciative of the antitrust portion of the legal code, but in this instance, it's highly warranted that they be prosecuted. They're going in what their model for 20 years. There was an article 5 years ago, 6 years ago, about how in two decades they basically made no profit for two decades.
Mm-hmm.
What they've done is they churned it all back in. They did everything they could to sabotage all their competitors. For example, and one of the examples I used, and I stumbled upon this in my research for the piece, everybody has heard the phrase, the retail phrase, Black Friday, which is the day after Thanksgiving. And the reason it's called Black Friday is because retailers are in the red all year until that day. And then they go in the black. Well, Bezos every year, going into the Christmas season, intentionally lowers his prices to below the cost to him. And he's doing this to undercut all the retailers. So he sells them at a loss, which destroys the retail. It's an anti-competitive practice. It is against the law, and for good reason. And doing that year after year for 20 years, and all of a sudden he's got an $800 million plus market cap, and we're hemorrhaging jobs and retail outlets. Now, I'm not a moron. I know that, you know, as soon as the internet came online, I thought this is going to hurt retail. But it should happen in a natural process. This is a highly unnatural process when Bezos does things like this.
You have a fascinating example about Toys R Us. We saw, you know, we all got hit in the feels a couple weeks ago. Those of us of a certain age, anyway.
Yes.
Got hit in the feels when Toys R Us closed, and, you know, Jeffrey the giraffe was saying bye-bye and heading off to the nature preserve, wherever he's living these days. And so you got this story here. I mean, and sort of the conventional wisdom was, well, you know, it's a brick-and-mortar a store in an online world scene. So, I mean, it was destined to happen. And maybe it was, but I didn't realize this. I mean, so back in 2000, right, you say Toys R Us cut a deal with Amazon, and they were going to be the only retailer to sell toys on Amazon.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that's huge, but you say that
I
Amazon started...
I remember how nascent the internet was in 2000.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to think of now, but you think about how nascent the internet was in 2000. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we're all still on dial-up.
Right.
You know, then you say Amazon started violating the exclusive deal, so they started offering toys from other retailers. 2004, Toys R Us sues... And they won a lawsuit against Amazon that, as you write, quote, or as the coverage of the Times said, quote, will allow the toy seller to set up its own website and end an agreement to sell products on Amazon's site. So they entered into this agreement with Amazon. Amazon violates the agreement. Toys R Us sues and receives permission to actually build ToysRUs.com.
Yeah.
Wow.
They had no website until 2006. Which, as you know, that made them a decade late. Not just in having a website, but in acquiring the knowledge that goes into being a successful online retailer. So they were completely cut off at the knees by Amazon. And I think this was intentional by Amazon. Even then, I think Bezos knew what he was doing. He was crippling, you know, at the time. You know, I should have looked it up. I was running out of time. I had other stuff going on. I wanted to go look it up and see if I could find if Toys R Us was the biggest toy retailer at the time. And Bezos wanted to do this for the same thing. He's doing the exact same thing. He's done the exact same thing to bookstores. He sold books at a loss. He sold his Kindle reader at a loss for years and years and years. He destroyed the brick-and-mortar bookstore, and now he's opening bookstores. So it's not like there's not a market for brick-and-mortar retail bookstores. He just killed all the competitors, and now he's opening them. And he's doing that with two toy stores, too. He blew up. The reason I think Toys R Us may have been the biggest was because he obviously went out of his way to, you know, give them special, you know, Amazon treatment with this exclusive deal. And then, of course, immediately started violating it. And so he's killed Toys R Us. Now what is he doing? He's looking into purchasing the old Toys R Us locations to open Amazon toy stores. He's starting to offer a holiday catalog just like Toys R Us used to do. So it's not like the marketplace doesn't want these things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's that Amazon killed the other people doing these things so that they can do it themselves.
All right, so you talk about you not being a huge fan of all of the antitrust laws and the way that they're set up in this country, but you think that that Amazon has run afoul of the laws that are on the books?
If you're selling at a loss, yes. That's now, I'm not a lawyer, and
right.
Like I said, I've been so antithetical to antitrust for so long, I'm just now starting to read, you know, how these things work and what the laws call for and all that. But I'm almost positive that you cannot sell at a loss for years and years and years and not have violated antitrust law. I'm pretty sure that's That's why antitrust laws exist. And so that's why he concentrated for two plus decades on just growing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So when he entered a new sector or entered a sector, he was big enough to absorb the losses to destroy all his competitors in that sector. That was the business model from day one. He's a genius. Bezos is a genius, obviously, but he's using his powers for evil instead of good.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was a book that came out a few years ago, probably 3 years ago now, by a reporter down in Roanoke, Virginia, named Beth Macy, and the book's called Factory Man, and it's about the Bassett Furniture Factory, in particular, one guy who's sort of the one independent member of the Bassett Furniture Factory, because, you know, if you drive through Southwest Virginia, like I'm going to Bristol this weekend, if you drive down through Danville and Martinsville and you get into, like Mount Airy, North Carolina, and that part of the country, that used to be the furniture capital of the world.
Yeah.
Right? And then in the 80s and early 90s and continuing on today, the Chinese companies started coming out with products that were cheaper than what we were able to make here in the United States. So this guy, John Bassett, he's watching all of this happen in his industry, and then he sees in a catalog one day one of his bedroom suites, because it all started out like the Chinese companies started with like the knick-knack tables. They started with the simple stuff, right? And then they would move into the more complex pieces of furniture. And so John Bassett one day sees one of his bedroom suites that's available for sale from a Chinese company. It's his design and everything, and it's cheaper than what it costs him to make. That product for. So he sends his son over to China to investigate what's going on. Again, it's this fascinating book, but in essence, the Chinese government was subsidizing the Chinese furniture industry.
Exactly.
And selling again, doing exactly what you talk about, selling at a loss to put American companies out of business. And once they had taken over that industry, well, maybe
then
the subsidies...
Whatever the heck they want.
Exactly. The subsidies can stop because now you don't have the competition. This book was all about, you know, how John Bassett fought back, actually took some of these Chinese companies to court, and actually gets a payment now from these from the government, because basically the Chinese are doing this. It's not a perfect solution, but it highlights the problem. And it's just interesting to see that happens not only globally...
This is a combo story of intellectual property theft and cronyism, right?
Yeah.
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 Right. And this book is called what? Because I'm going to look into this.
It's called Factory Man by Beth Macy.
Factory Man.
It's fantastic. It's one of the best books I've read in probably the last 5 years.
Well, you know, and I think you and I have discussed this before. You know, I hate the Farm Bill as much as anybody. But, you know, the example I use as far as government subsidies are concerned is, look, there are over 100 countries that sell sugar on the global market. Brazil controls half the market, 50% of the market. Thailand controls 10% more. How do these two countries dominate a 100-plus country market? Because Brazil subsidizes sugar $4 billion a year, and Thailand does 2.3.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not fair trade. This
right.
is exactly the thing. Like you said, the Chinese government was subsidizing the furniture makers, who were also stealing the ideas, but they were subsidizing the furniture makers to wipe out Bassett. And this is not fair trade. This is not, you know, these knee-jerk, you know, libertarian Tourette syndrome who say, you know, tariffs are taxes and you know, free trade. And this is not free trade. This is completely the opposite of free trade. And, you know, whether you like the tariffs or not, at least Trump identified the problem and is addressing it in some fashion. You may not like the fashion, but at least look at the conversion and the discussion in the last 2 years since he came on. It went from no discussion of Chinese IP theft to everyone knowing, you know, everyone just accepting that it's happening. All these subsidies, all these imbalanced tariffs and trade limitations and all that, from not even discussed to, well, we know we're doing it, but we don't like your tariffs. Well, that's a huge progress. That's a lot of progress being made. And it's not free trade. It's not fair trade. And this has been going on for decades. So we're going to be talking about this for a while, because even if the guy that succeeds Trump continues on this, you know, to try to undo this, there's so much to undo. It's going to take a while.
Okay, well, let me ask you. We've only got like 2 minutes left here, but real quick, why is the answer? I mean, look, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would say, see, this is why we need democratic socialism, so we can, you know, go soak the billionaires and we can punish them for what they've done here. Why is the answer not a straight up redistribution of wealth? Let's go after Jeff Bezos and take his billions away and give it to the little people.
Because I forget what it was, but if they'd taken all the money, not just the income, but all the money from the upper 1% in America, it would fund the government for like 2.5 weeks. You know, and of course, the punitive effect of that level of taxation, the number of people that will drive completely out of the workforce because they do the math on the back of a napkin and realize it's not worth it to go to work if you're going to have, 85-90% of the money taken from you. That's why the answer. The answer is, it's the same argument I get from the libertarians. I'm so tired of libertarians. I have been for years. Now I'm really sick of them. But they say, oh, you just want, you're a big government guy because you want ICE on the borders. Yeah, because they get $250 billion a year in government money. So yeah, I'll spend a little more up front to save on the back end. And that's the way it is with these trade things. Yeah, I'll take a little more government up front because on the back end, the payoff is, 50-1, 100-1, 1,000-1. So in the long game, in the big picture, it is demonstrably less government to take these positions than it is to look at the little, 72-hour window and say, oh, you're spending more on border enforcement. Well, yeah, we are.
We got to leave it there, buddy. I appreciate you coming on the program. Seton Motley with Less Government. All right, coming up top of the hour, we've got more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. Gabby Franco of Tips and Tactics joining us as well. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company next. Ashley Oblinsky of the Cody Farmers Museum was very excited to see Ted here on set, weren't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got my picture taken with him.
Well, it's good to see you today.
It's good to see you.
How's your week been so far?
Oh, it's been crazy. Well, we started actually last week because of antique arms at the Westgate.
Yeah.
The big firearms antique show over there. Usually it's after SHOT Show, but because SHOT Show was a week later this year, I got to go to that where I wasn't ill for the first time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we had we were set up there and then came here, and it's been wonderful, but I haven't had a free minute. It's crazy.
I'm sure. Well, and that, that's kind of like 2018 in a microcosm for you, actually. It sounds like there's a lot of stuff going on at the Cody Firearms Museum this year.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we are actually renovating the museum. I know we've been talking about it for a long time, and there's lots of phases of design, but as of next week, the design is done. We have 6,000 objects slated for display, and then 20,000 probably rounds of ammunition.
Wow.
That's even going to go into the museum. And so we're upping our number of guns by like 2,000, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So we already were at 50% on display at that point. But yeah, we are starting construction in August, and we will have a temporary exhibition, so don't worry. If you still come to the museum, you'll still be able to see over 500 guns.
Okay.
And then we have our grand opening July 4th, 2019.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be kind of down for that. I'd love to come out for that, by the way, the big grand opening next
you
year.
You should. You should. Well, I'll send you an invite.
Okay. Please do. And you also have a symposium taking place later this year, right?
Yeah. That was really interesting. We started it last year. Actually, a year before, several of the curators, the NRA, Jim Sapieca was there,
mm-hmm.
Were invited to do a small roundtable at the Aspen Institute, believe it or not, after a firearms and common law symposium. They had scholars on both sides of the debate, and we came on at the end, and it was such a good discussion. We were like, we've got to keep this going. And so I did a symposium last year with you guys were there. We had the Met, the Smithsonian. We had the Royal Armories over in England. We had a professor from the Art Institute of Chicago who has forced a firearms design course.
Wow.
At the Art Institute. And so we had scholars. We had museum professionals. We didn't think we'd get that many people, and we ended up with like 70 different people, different institutions on our second day workshop. And we decided at the end of that day that this needs to continue because one of the things that we want to do is continue to create an environment for people to learn about guns, study history, because
mm-hmm.
there aren't really a lot of gun courses that you can get in universities, believe it or not.
Right.
And so we are making an association starting this symposium of firearms museum professionals and historians so that we can start to put more classes in universities, start to teach other museums that have guns collections, but no one on staff that knows about guns.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that we're trying to raise awareness about is the fact that firearms museums, if they're not state or federal, have to abide by gun laws. So we are affected by the Hughes Amendment. We're affected by the NFA. If something's unregistered and it's awesome. We still can't collect it.
And
Modern, you know, any machine gun made out of after 86 can't have it. You know, one of the things we're looking at in the new museum is we have a Gatling gun that was one of the Gatling guns that was used, stripped down, put belts on it. It was part of the Vulcan project, which also ultimately, you know, is the foundation for modern, you know, aircraft armaments and the minigun. And I was like, how cool would it be to have that gun in that configuration in a Dillon minigun? Like right next to it.
Right?
We can't have it.
We can't do it.
The law letter doesn't apply to us. And so it's something that I don't think a lot of people know about. And so we as museum professionals, we all individually know. And so we're doing an entire workshop on the laws and what we can do. And we're hoping the ATF can be there because we've actually been talking to them about some of the things that we, you know, may or may not be able to accomplish. But if we don't change that policy, then, you know, 100 years from now, we'll have lost some really valuable history.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. On the program this hour, Gabby Franco from Tips and Tactics here at NRA TV, talking about the latest in her native land of Venezuela, where thieves are now plundering headstones in order to steal them and to try to get, you know, just a couple of bolivars in their pocket, well, a couple thousand of them. I guess a couple tens of thousands of bolivars in their pocket so they can buy their family a meal. Because a cup of coffee, from what I understand now in Venezuela, will cost you about a million. I don't want to overestimate it. A million bolivars for a cup of coffee. Used to be you could kind of exchange bolivars for dollars, but not so much anymore. We'll talk with Gabby about that again later on in the hour. Coming up an hour from now, our hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. Also, A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart and Kurt Schlichter at Town Hall next hour. Now, we've got a news out of California. We talked earlier in the week with Chuck Michelle, president of the California Rifle and Pistol Association, about what's going on out there, where he had this deadline for owners of semi-automatic rifles that the state of California has now deemed to be quote-unquote assault weapons. And those California gun owners had a couple of things that they could do. They could either turn their firearms into quote-unquote featureless rifles so they are no longer considered by the state of California to be quote-unquote assault weapons, or they could register their firearms with the state of California. Those gun owners who tried to register their firearms with the state of California could not do so in the days before this deadline. You would go to the website, and the website wasn't accepting your information, or you'd start to fill out the form, and then it would hang up, or maybe you even filled out everything. You hit enter, and then you're just not really sure. Nothing really happened, so did I submit this or not? Then there were the issues about other people's information that was apparently being viewed, was popping up on people's computer screens as they went to the DOJ website there to try to register their firearms. So you've got a lawsuit filed out in California yesterday regarding this issue, saying that since the state of California could not make their system work, you shouldn't be holding gun owners accountable for the failures of the state of California. Under this new law, people in possession of unregistered assault weapons face criminal prosecution with penalties of up to a year behind bars, as well as confiscation of that firearm. Representatives for Attorney General Xavier Becerra's office did not respond immediately to a request for comment. Not surprising. And declined to say how many people filed applications to register their firearms. I'm sure that'll all come out in a data breach from the Cal DOJ at some point in the very near future. So we'll continue to keep our eyes on that. Meanwhile, out in Scarsdale, New York. Where is Scarsdale, Cameron? Is that Westchester County?
Yes, exactly. Just north of New York City.
Okay. So real conservative area is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Deep red.
Deep red. Absolutely.
Okay. The West Virginia of New York State.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they call it,
it.
Scarsdale, Tucky.
Well, I you know, so there's this story from one of the local sites there in Scarsdale, Scarsdale10583.com, about a push there in Scarsdale, very similar to what we've seen in Piscataway, New Jersey, to try to ban gun stores from opening up. They're not just targeting gun stores in Scarsdale. Cameron, care to hazard a guess as to what other industry they're trying to ban from opening?
Oh, in Scarsdale. I'm going to say...
It's a retail location. I'll give you that. So, no, I'm not talking about strip clubs or anything like
right,
that.
Right, right. No socket, no guns, no... other than guns, it seems like everything goes in places like Scarsdale. I'm lost.
Vape shops.
Oh! I'm an idiot, of course. Of course, yes, because that's the problem.
Yep. Yeah. So Scarsdale 10583 says, after a gun store opened in Harrison, New York, there in Westchester County in late 2016, many Westchester communities, including Scarsdale, have been taking precautionary measures to restrict the ability for gun shop owners to open stores in their municipalities. The Scarsdale website writes, the recent vaping crisis in Scarsdale, however, has emboldened the board to make the proposed gun store provisions also apply to vape shops. So I have to ask you, Cameron, have you heard about the great Scarsdale vape crisis?
I haven't, but it sounds deadly.
I'm looking this up right now just to see, because a crisis. Let's see, here's something from the New York Times. I can't stop school struggle with vaping explosion. But I there's nothing specific about Scarsdale. So I don't know. If you can do some research.
I will.
There's got to be a story there somewhere.
All right.
So apparently now they're trying to add the gun store thing they were already doing. Now they're trying to add in the vaping. I'm pretty sure that there's a local religious leader there in Scarsdale. Looks a lot like the actor John Lithgow. He also wants to try to ban dancing in the community, but so far not been able to put that on the ballot. The board there in Scarsdale has proposed that gun and vape shops be strictly limited to a specific zone there in the town, which, as the website says, encompasses a, quote, tiny portion of Garth Road between the Freightway and Eastchester border. So it sounds like there's a postage stamp size plot of land there in Scarsdale, that the town says, okay, this is where the gun and vape shop should be. Now, it's interesting. Note, though, that theoretically, they're still allowing gun shops to open up. That's important. Piscataway, New Jersey, is not. They're just outlawing it. They've written the zoning laws in such a way that there's nowhere in town that you could conceivably open up a gun store without running afoul of their zoning ordinances. And it sounds like that was kind of the original intent there in Scarsdale, but they realized, okay, that might get legally challenged. So it's better for us to have at least a theoretical location where a gun store could open up. Quote, the board proposed restrictive zoning over a blanket ban of these stores due to fear of serious litigation that could ensue, since it's difficult to limit what a store can sell. Former village attorney Wayne Esonison compared these stores to the adult entertainment stores in New York City. The city could not enforce an outright ban on these stores, so instead they took measures to severely restrict the locations in which these stores can be located. New Village attorney Angela Martin added that a California municipality did implement a gun store ban and was brought to court over the issue, but was ultimately upheld by the court in their ban. She stressed that Scarsdale wouldn't necessarily see an identical outcome if a similar ban was implemented. You know, again, we told you when Piscataway, New Jersey, implemented their gun store ban under the provisions, again, of just a zoning law. We told you other communities were going to be doing this. I said this earlier in the week. The gun control advocates are using every avenue available to them. They don't have 6 million members. They don't have a grassroots army. What they do have in every community are a few individuals, or in most communities, a few individuals who are either soft supporters of gun control or hardcore proponents of it. And they've got a deep-pocketed donor in Michael Bloomberg. They've got a lot of celebrities who can also kick in some cash, provide some social cachet to the cause. But that money from Bloomberg is funding a lot of litigation. Again, they're offering to pick up the tab when communities are challenging, statewide preemption laws for existence. These gun control groups are saying, listen, go ahead, write your own gun control laws, get sued in court. We'll pick up your legal fees. There's no loss to you, except maybe your laws don't get upheld, but at least you've tried to change the law and you're leading by example. That's their argument. And it's not just big cities. Clearly, when we're talking about Piscataway, New Jersey, Scarsdale, New York, and, you might say, look, these are places that are going to be anti-gun to begin with. It's not like they're walking into, Katy, Texas, or Conroe and doing the same thing. To that, I would say, give them time. Because they're not going to be happy stopping here. This is about building a base. This is about building that foundation. And they're probably looking forward to seeing some legal challenges in these courts, in anti-gun communities. Courts that would be more likely to uphold these zoning laws that hypothetically may allow for the existence of a gun store, but in all practicality, they really don't. They've already gotten some adverse decisions out of like the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, but this is Scarsdale. That's in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. It's Piscataway. They're in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So we are going to see more of this around the country. And it's, in fact, again, it's happening right now. So when you can, I realize we've all got our lives. We've got, kids and sports and it's summer and you've got summer vacation, but just know that every school board meeting you miss, there's probably going to be a gun control advocate there. And every city council meeting where there are no gun owners, probably going to be one or two Moms Demand Action members. Every county commission meeting where we don't show up, they'll have a few people there. They are looking for any and every opportunity that they can to push their agenda right now. Even again in places where we don't necessarily think about the gun control debate erupting. I suppose we can move on. We don't need to talk about the, I am kind of curious though about the vaping shops. Because they're apparently, again, if you're trying to ban vaping shops and you go into like the local convenience store and they're selling little vaping products, what do you do there? Apparently, this is interesting. One trustee there in Scarsborough said, he believes the intent is admirable. He questioned the effectiveness of any law that the board can't fully enforce. If only every elected official came to that same conclusion. Boy, this law sounds nice, but how are we actually going to enforce it? I also am finding out a little bit more information, Cameron, about the vaping crisis in Scarsdale.
Oh, good. Breaking news.
Right. Now, there's a kid named Jack Waxman, who is a former student at Scarsdale High, who created an anti-juuling documentary and has been outspoken on the issue of vaping in Scarsdale. He says that Scarsdale students are getting their vape paraphernalia online in neighboring areas and with fake IDs. And so, you shut down vape shops there in Scarsdale. You're not going to make a difference. But the mayor said, quote, "We can't change the world around us, but we can send a signal."
So are you telling me that if somebody wants something but they can't get it, they'll still find a way to get it? Is this, Cam, is this what you're saying to me? It seems very groundbreaking.
That is actually what I'm saying to you, yes. Blame Jeff Bezos. I think it actually goes back to what... what Seton was talking about last hour there. Yeah. Interesting enough. So the meetings opened up to public comment. Noah Kraloff used the public comment period to express support for the board's proactive efforts in stopping the spread of gun stores. Another way to put that would be stopping entrepreneurs from opening up their own small business in compliance with local, state, and federal laws. Noah, though, said, it's great what you're doing, but can't we pursue an outright ban? Can't we really just try to ban gun stores? Because, again, if we're just trying to send a signal, if we're just trying to send a message, why don't we just send that message? The one of the trustees said the board will come to a conclusion first on the proposed zoning limitations and stated that an outright ban would be legally disastrous before voting on any change to the current law. So, you know, and again, what's fascinating is that these trustees there in Scarsdale seem really intimately familiar with that case out of Alameda County, California. Now, I'm not saying that these trustees didn't do their research. They didn't just come up with this on their own, and they all started looking at this and, well what are they doing? What have they done elsewhere around the country? Oh, look at this. What happened in California? I mean, it could have happened. Could have happened. Also could have happened that, you know, gun control groups came to these trustees and said, hey, we'd really like you to consider doing something like this. You saw what they just did in Piscataway, right? And look, you've already got court cases out in California that show you that you can do this, and it's going to be upheld in a court of law. I kind of think that's more likely than these trustee members there in Scarsdale, New York, just coming up with this idea all on their own. And again, if it can happen in Scarsdale, it could happen in Scottsdale. It could happen anywhere. All right, stick around. We got to take a quick timeout. When we return, Gabby Franco from NRA's Tips and Tactics joining us, talking about something else that could happen anywhere, at least anywhere that adopts socialism. Now you've got thieves plundering headstones in order to try to make enough money selling those headstones to put food on the table for their family that night. Stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company coming up next.
So I'm talking with Dan Drake, the president and CEO of Odor Crusher. Dan, it's good to talk with you, sir.
No, thanks for coming out. Gosh.
I appreciate you becoming our on-location sponsor, the sponsor of our Good Guys segment on Cam and Company every day. So I want to thank you for that. Your name is known out there. This is a great product, and I think, you know, I'm really pleased that so many folks have such a positive response. But for folks who maybe haven't heard of Odor Crusher,
right,
let's talk about what it is that this company is all about.
Absolutely. So we started out really on the hunting side of the business with Scent Crusher. So hunters started using the products, and we were named the best new product in the hunting industry for a couple of years in a row. And really, it was my friends I had in law enforcement that went, gosh, can we use this on the law enforcement side? Will you teach us, or will you make something for us that's specific to us? So what our technology does is we use ozone, and you put it in one of our bags or closets or in the car, and we blow ozone into it, and it kills all the smell and, more importantly, the bacteria that sits there. So in the hunting world, you can now be 20 yards from a deer because they can't smell you. In the sports world, it kills all the smells in hockey, football, soccer. But in the military, tactical, and police side, it now will take care of all that body armor, your helmets, your shoes, your gloves that you can't clean anymore.
That's amazing. All right, so can we kind of like look and see some of the products here?
Yep. So this is kind of the hunting side of the business, and again, closets and bags that you can put all your stuff in, and then we'll go down and we'll look at the tactical side of the business.
Sure, absolutely. Come with me. So what are we looking at here, Dan?
So this is really kind of our full line of stuff that we created for police officers, military, and tactical side. So these are range bags or duty bags that officers have, fully mollied up, set up here so they can put pens and business cards and, you know, whatever they need or are going to use on a daily basis, and the same on the inside, all mollied up, separated to be able to be used, you know, clipboards set to set up their cell phones, whatever they're doing for the day that sits right next to them. So again, they can now take their tactical gear, their bulletproof vest at the end of the day, throw it in here, plug it in their cigarette lighter, plug it into their wall outlet at home, and they're set. It's as simple as, let's turn this on here, turning it on, hitting the button, running it for 30 minutes, boom, everything's clean.
That's it?
That's
amazing.
That's it. So,
all right, so I know it's not magic, because I know you said ozone, but yeah, this kind of seems like
like magic. How does this actually work?
So I actually hired two guys from NASA who had done the International Space Station in ozone to design the products originally. So ozone is the O3 molecule, oxygen's the O2. In nature, electricity or lightning blows apart the oxygen molecules and they make ozone. It's that fresh smell that you have after a rainstorm. So we've essentially created a little mini electrical storm in here, made the ozone, harvested it off, and blown it into a bag or a backpack or a closet. In 45 minutes, it becomes oxygen again. So there's nothing harmful about it. It's nature's way of kind of cleaning the bacteria and stuff that sits in the environment.
And you guys, it seems like you have a full lineup here. I mean, we're looking, as you say, like, you know, this would be a great range bag, but you've got some, big boys over here, right?
So this is... this is kind of our first responding actor shooter backpack, so you can pull it up over you and have front and back protection for you if you need that. A regular backpack here to carry around, or, you know, we've got giant bags here, so you can put your gun or your bow or whatever you might have underneath here and then carry around all your gear inside. And again, same technology sits right here.
That's amazing. And even the hard case stuff. Now, this, I got to tell you, with our crew, because we pack a lot of stuff every time we go on the road, so we're using these hard cases. And honestly, I mean, I had a lot of our guys say, hey, let's look at this stuff. So this is, I mean, this is amazing. This is an actual chest right here.
It is, you know, rough, tough, handle, wheels. You guys can toss it around. And then at the end of the day, throw all your gear in here, hit the button, 30 minutes, it's all clean.
This is the coolest stuff, Dan. I got to tell you, I'm really, really impressed. How can folks get one for their own? You know, how can they get one to purchase?
We are working with distributors now on the LE side. We've got 15 or 20 distributors around the country. Or you can go to our website, odorcrusher.com, or on Amazon and find the gear and buy it.
Awesome. Now, where is Odorcrusher located? Where's HQ for you?
Wichita, Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
The Midwest.
I love it. All right, odorcrusher.com. Dan Drake, thank you so much for spending some time
thank
with us, sir. It's great talking with you today. Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. I'll be loading up my Odorcrusher range bag, which also doubles as an overnight bag, as I head down to Bristol this weekend to the Bristol Motor Speedway, where... coming up August 18th, don't forget, we got the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Gabby Franco, host of Tips and Tactics here on NRA TV. Gabby, how are you today?
Very good, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you joining us on the program. And, you know, I could ask you to come on the show every day, Gabby, because every day I see these headlines out of Venezuela. But I don't want to bother you. I know you've got a life to live. But this one, I saw this one. I was like, okay, you know what? This one we got to talk to Gabby about. So the headline from Fox News, thieves plunder headstones as Venezuela's crisis turns grave. Ignore the awful pun there. I mean, what we're talking about are grave markers being desecrated, the brass, you know, on graves, anything that could be taken and sold on the black market for just, you know, for scraps. You know, you're now seeing this systemic destruction of Venezuelan society even reach into the graveyards.
Well, there is a point where right now Venezuela, the whole society itself, has lost respect to everything, has lost respect for the living and has lost respect for the dead. And many people are in the mode of survival, and it's not an excuse of what they're doing. And the problem with that is that they are taking what is, for most people, one of the most precious things. It's the last memory that they have, the sacred place for, you know, visiting the people, parents and children that people have lost. And that, you know, sacred place is just being violated right now. And, you know, Venezuela, the crisis, it's beyond people's understanding here in the United States. Some people don't really understand, don't have a grasp of how bad the situation is, because even the poorest person here in the United States, they still have support in one way or another. Back in Venezuela, the vast majority of people are pretty much in misery right now. And it is just devastating what is happening right now in Venezuela. And just hearing headlines like this one is just a few of the bad ones that, like you say, happen every day.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and just I would encourage folks, because this doesn't always make the headlines. Like the last time the national media talked about Venezuela, it was because there was a story about Donald Trump had talked to advisors about, well, you know, what about military intervention? And of course, this, you know, allowed the press to run with Donald Trump wants to invade Venezuela stories. And that was sort of the last time, again, you know, the national media paid attention to it. Miami Herald does a good job, I think, of continually reporting what's going on in Venezuela. But short of that, you know, you don't get a lot of national coverage about what's going on in that nation. And part of that should be noted. There aren't a lot of reporters down there in Venezuela that are covering this story. It is, sadly, Gabby, it's turned into a hellhole. And, you know, I got to tell you, I mean, I talk to people in New York or Massachusetts or California, and they'll tell me, like, how they've seen their state turn anti-gun. And, you should have seen this place, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It used to be so much better. And I think about that, and I commiserate with them, but I always think about you. Because, you know, look, 5 years ago, Venezuela banned the private ownership of guns. But that's just one component of what you have watched happen to the place where you grew up.
Yeah, in reality, and like I've said several times, the thing is that everything happens in slow motion when it comes to this kind of socialist ideas, control ideas, telling the government is here for you and give you everything. Everything, they are patient. They work in a slow motion. They take little by little until there's a point where people get used to it. And I tell that a lot, and that's why I go to California and I give my seminars and I talk about the Second Amendment, because you have to keep those people motivated to keep fighting for their rights. These socialists, like happened in Venezuela, they went little by little taking parts of the country, and they really, because they have the government, they are in charge, they have the power of the law enforcement, military back in Venezuela. So, as civilians, they can fight so much when they don't have anything to protect themselves against the armed forces ruled by the regime of Nicolas Maduro. So things are getting harder and harder. So what is happening right now is that the Venezuelans, they are into a point where desperation has led them to say, you know what, I cannot live with this anymore. I need to find ways to protect my family, give them food, something. And it's amazing how things go slowly. And here in the United States, people take that for granted, saying, oh, no, that just happened in California. Oh, no, that happens just in New Jersey. It's not going to happen here in Texas or in Arizona. I'm like, you know, if you don't fight where the fight is need to be fought, it's going to go and spread out everywhere.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Gabby. And so I'm curious. I realize I didn't ask you to come on and talk about this, but you know, there's the hot new buzzword in politics these days is democratic socialism. And you'll hear folks say, well, that's different than Venezuela. Cause this is all about, you know, don't you like firefighters, Gabby? Don't you like police officers? Don't you like public libraries? That's what democratic socialism is all about. It's just about the happy stuff. And you don't have to worry about Venezuela. We're not talking about Venezuela. We want like Norway. We don't want the failed state. We want what we think is a successful state. How worried are you as somebody who, you know, left Venezuela, and left the Chavistas behind? How worried are you when you hear people in the United States start talking about the glories of socialism here?
Well, let me tell you something, short story. Before I turned 22 years old, I had already traveled a dozen of countries. Yes, I have visited Canada, Australia, Finland, Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and some countries in South America as well. And where am I? In the United States. Because the little I learned of those countries was that in the United States, if you work hard, you can succeed. This is a country where you can achieve, because you don't have to beg for the government to give you anything. You don't have to beg for that big name government to tell you, oh yeah, I'll take care of you. I don't need the government to take care of me because they don't know where my needs are. They can say, okay, your needs are to just have a bag of bread for a week and rice for a month. That are not my needs. I want more than that. The problem is that those people who like the socialists, they just are people who are don't look beyond that. You know, don't just think about your children, how they can achieve. We can all work together. We can all work together, and I believe in helping others. But how can we make those that we're helping accountable for that help that they are receiving? Because that's a problem that most people say, oh, yes, less the rich is going to give the poor. And by all means, I'm not even close to be rich. But you know what? I cannot take from them that they have worked hard. They probably have studied and spent a lot of years in the university more than I did. So I cannot blame them for their wealth. At the same time, if we are going to give the poor, fine. But how can we make them accountable? Then make them accountable that they go out and look for jobs. They don't want to stay there. Just give me, give me, give me. That's the deal. You know, I think it's important to help others, but also make those we're helping accountable for their actions, accountable for their desire to get out of drugs, get out of, you know, getting alcohol and get out and make something for themselves. The problem with the socialists is that we give to everybody no matter what. And that never works because there's a point where money is going to run out because people who are successful, who are working hard, who are achievers, they get tired of their efforts to be given away for nothing. So, I mean, there is a reason why I always tell people, if you give people around the world an option to go to one country to find success. They have anywhere around the world to find success, and they will choose the United States. I guarantee you that.
Gabby Franco, listen, it is always so good talking with you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Cam. And, you know, I'm here whenever you guys want me to be on the show.
All right, well, that's good to know. I'll start bugging you a little more often then, knowing that you're available.
Thank you.
Gabby Franco with us. Make sure you're following Gabby on Twitter, by the way, at GabbyFrancoTS4 and online at GabbyFranco.com. Would you love to hear Gabby talk with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cameron? I would love to.
Oh, that would be so unfair. Oh, <That'd> be brutal.
Be amazing. I did see this. This is from WHYY, Public Radio in Pennsylvania. The State Republican Party, I can't do the public radio voice more than like a sentence, sorry. The State Republican Party launching a new strategy for this fall's congressional elections, making and distributing lists of which Democrats support socialized programs, among other things. Party Chairman Val DiGiorgio. So the effort comes in response to four candidates backed by Democratic Socialists of America winning state legislative primaries. Did you hear about that, by the way? Probably not. But this is, I think, mostly Western PA. And again, you know, winning a primary fight doesn't guarantee you winning the general election. But if you want to see where the energy is among the Democratic base, it's not with the Biden-esque or even Hillary Clinton-esque candidates out there. More with the... again, the Democratic Socialist moniker, that is the hot phrase right now in Democratic politics. So the Republicans are mailing surveys to all of the Democrats running for Congress. So they plan to use the responses or lack thereof in campaign material. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the return rate on the survey that the Republicans are sending to Democrats is going to be close to zero. I mean, I hate to break it to the GOP chairman there. Pretty sure the Democratic candidates aren't going to be really eager to send that survey back to the GOP. Besides asking if candidates support the Democratic Socialists of America, the surveys ask whether they support House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and whether they agree with Congresswoman Maxine Waters' call to heckle the president's cabinet members in public. WHYY says DiGiorgio did not draw any distinctions when it came to DSA support, saying he isn't aware of any difference between socialism and democratic socialism. They said, quote, as we saw in Venezuela, socialism tends towards totalitarianism and the loss of freedoms. We think it can very easily lead to communism and the kinds of abuses we saw under communism. It's funny to me that WHYY kind of tries to ding the chairman there of the GOP in Pennsylvania for not drawing distinctions between socialism and democratic socialism. When the distinctions, if you ask a democratic socialist, for example, the distinctions that you will get are generally things like, don't you support firefighters? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had this tweet the other day that was just kind of silly, and it was about wait till the GOP hears about public libraries. So the argument is that you're already a democratic socialist if you support public libraries, if you support funding for law enforcement, if you support funding for firefighters, right? That's the argument. Now, my response would be, well, if that's the case, then why do you guys have to call yourselves socialists? Why would you just call yourselves Democrats? What makes it socialism? Back in the 1936, the Communist Party of the United States of America, which had, big ideas when the Great Depression came along. They thought, oh, this is our time. You've got the economic collapse of capitalism here in the West. You've got the Soviet Union to look to as the guiding light. As they got in like the 1932 election, they were really militant about what it is that they wanted. And they wanted a Soviet America. By the time the 36 elections rolled around, it was pretty clear that, okay, we weren't going to become Bolsheviks here in the United States. That wasn't going to work. And so the Communist Party of the United States adopted this whole new campaign of communism is 20th century Americanism. And that was their watchword. And at the party rallies in New York City, you actually had, big banners of George Washington on one side of the stage and Karl Marx on the other side of the stage, or Thomas Jefferson and Lenin. Abraham Lincoln and Stalin, right? It was communism's 20th century Americanism. It's just all we want are things like these New Deal programs and things like, Social Security and things like that. That's all we want. That really isn't all that they wanted. I go back to what we were talking about with New York 21 and Tedra Cobb just not even being honest about where she stands on a gun ban. This is one of the things that, as a voter, really bothers me. Now, look, personally, I'm not ever going to vote for a far-left candidate. It's just not my politics. But I would appreciate the far-left candidate being honest about their politics and policies. And it does kind of make me wonder why you won't be if you're not. What are you holding back? And just like up in, New York 21, where Tedra Cobb says, listen, if I say that I'm in favor of a gun ban, I'm going to lose the election. I think that there are a lot of democratic socialists out there who have this feeling of, well, if we really explain what democratic socialism is all about, we're not going to win. That's going to be a bridge too far. So let's talk about it like it's just public libraries and funding for firefighters and law enforcement, because who's opposed to that, as opposed to actually really exploring what makes this such a, no pun intended, such a great leap forward, such a cultural revolution, if you will, Cameron, in terms of, the flowering of democratic socialism as opposed to just being a Democrat.
The whole thing's just so uncomfortable. But I'm glad you're calling it out.
And yet, here we are. So there you go. Spokesman for the State Democratic Party called the survey, by the way, a gimmick. And said that the policies Democrats, including the congressional candidate support, are focused on helping working families. It is a gimmick. It's an election gimmick, but it's also a gimmick, as most good gimmicks are, designed to raise a larger point. And that is to clarify what it is actually that democratic socialists are calling for. What makes them different than Democrats? Besides, we're younger, we don't like Nancy Pelosi, we want to get dark money out of politics. Bloomberg's spending $80 million this election. What actually makes you a socialist? And it's interesting, every time I've actually tried to ask that question of somebody who self-identifies as a democratic socialist, I've yet to really get an honest answer. It's just weird. I mean, I can ask gun owners, why are you a gun owner?
give me an honest answer. I can ask meat eaters, why are you a meat eater? I can ask vegans, why are you a vegan? And you'll get a very long, honest answer. And it'll probably be, you know, there'll be some fist pounding as well with that honest answer. But you'll get an honest answer. If you ask, what is socialism? You can ask, why are you a socialist? And people tell me, because I care about people, because I want to see, you know, working families be able to actually work. I don't want health care to literally cost an arm and a leg. I don't want people to have to go into debt to go to college. You can get the whys, but if you try to actually, you know, what is socialism? You ask a vegan, what is veganism? They'll tell you. You ask a gun owner, what's being a gun owner about? They'll tell you. What is socialism? It's just, you know, it's just like police and firefighters and paying for roads and stuff like that. That's all it is. And I just don't buy that. That doesn't make any sense to me. All right, stick around. I'm just a simple bumpkin. What do I know? But it just doesn't resonate. I'm not, you know, maybe if I were a cosmopolitan, Cameron, hanging out in the bodegas of Queens on a daily basis, I would understand this thing. Maybe it's just because I'm just here in Farmville, but I don't know. I just doesn't. No, I'm not getting it. It's not sinking in.
The way you're talking about Farmville developing, you might be getting cosmopolitan. So let's be careful.
I mean, listen, we're going to have two breweries here in Farmville before long.
I mean, this is like, the next thing will be a mustache wax shop. You just better calm down there.
I got to check the zoning laws because I'm thinking that now might be the time to actually open up my goat yoga studio.
It sounds like
it would not have worked a year ago. It may work now.
It sounds great.
All right, when we come back, we'll have more of the day's top segment of news and information. Top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well. As we head into our break, we have a brand new Curator's Corner for you. This week, John Popp talking to NRA Museums Director Jim Sapieca, as well as Senior Curator Phil Schreier. It's another Gun Gurus reunion on the set of the 2018 NRA Annual Meetings in Dallas. And this time, they've got Lynn Wood, as well as C.B. Wilson of the Smith & Wesson Collectors Association. And they have another silver medal award-winning entry. From the show, it is the Smith & Wesson First Model Russian with holster, owned by a name you might remember from your Old West history, John Wesley Hardin. Take a look and a listen to a brand new Curator's Corner right here on NRA TV.
And we are back here at the NRA Annual Meeting 2018 in Dallas, Texas, with Jim Sapieca and Phil Schreier from the NRA Museums, a reunion of sorts of the Gun Gurus here on Curator's Corner, but or also sort of a Gun Gurus takeover, because you guys run an incredible show and awards here at the annual meeting. We love to take advantage of that. So you're bringing over some beautiful things, some wonderful people. So tell us, what do you have for us now?
Well, this is a subject and a gun and a collection very near and dear to my heart. This is a great Smith & Wesson. This display was one of our display award winners, and this gun is certainly a silver medal winner. It's one of the top 10 guns in the show. It is a Smith & Wesson First Model Russian. Then the cool thing is it was owned by John Wesley Hardin. And it also has this holster that has become maybe the most iconic Old West holster I can think of that belonged to John Wesley Hardin with the loops on it. Lynn was nice enough to bring her collection here and show it to us. But you've had some folks behind you in this collection. This is a three-generation collection?
Yes. My grandfather started this in 1950 and got passed down to my dad, and now I'm the third generation to take it over.
Well, you brought beautiful, beautiful early Smith & Wessons, and certainly you guys tell the history of the Smith & Wesson, especially in the American West. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about John Wesley Hardin, and then how did you get this gun? And what everybody wants to know is, how did you know this is his gun?
Sure. Well, John Wesley Hardin used this gun to shoot Deputy Sheriff Charles Webb in Comanche in 1874. It was his 21st birthday.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was captured by the sheriff there, Sheriff Carnes, and a big mob was coming up and wanted to take over. And so Carnes felt like it was best to let Hardin go. So he let him go. And in the confusion, he was giving him back his gun, and he dropped it. And so Sheriff Carnes kept it, and it was on display in the drugstore there in Comanche for many years. And then a gentleman, Harvey Lumpkin, asked if he could use it for his night watchman's firearm. So he had it for his night watchman's gun. And then he sold it to a gentleman, Roy Sherrill, who was a county postal person, and he would actually use it to shoot rabbits with.
There's not much left of the rabbit.
Yeah.
44 caliber.
Yeah, Cheryl had it from about 1911, and my grandfather knew Cheryl very well, and he's written affidavits that is the gun that was used to shoot Charles Webb with. And
well, you folks have done exceptional research on that, and that is especially tough with outlaw guns because there are all kinds of outlaw attributed guns, but when you have one with this type of solid documentation going back multiple generations with folks who had the foresight to record this, and you've done some history going around the area and talking to the old folks who had seen this gun in exhibits when they were kids.
Yeah.
CB, tell us a little bit about the display that the club brought out for us here today. Back in the booth, what was the theme of your exhibit?
The theme that Lim's exhibit covered was the whole single action era, from in trying to illustrate the role that Smith & Wesson has played in the development of firearms, from the seminal development of the bored through cylinder, which is the basis of all modern revolvers, and the innovation that they put into the improvement from that period in the 1850s to develop automatic ejection systems and add stocks and make a revolving rifle and make marketing improvements to sell their products to the Russians and to the Turkish governments and to Japan and develop a global economy back in the 1800s.
Everybody thinks about Colts of the Old West, but they were hard-pressed to keep up with Smith & Wesson in terms of the number of revolvers produced during that era.
Right, and Smith & Wesson produced, you know, more guns for Russia in certain periods than they did even for America, but they produced the first U.S. military cartridge handgun, the first one for police agencies.
Well, thank you guys so much.
Of firsts, and that's what we try to illustrate.
Wonderful exhibit.
Thanks for sharing on Curator's Corner.
Welcome back. Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. In the heart of Virginia, about 3 hours or so south of Washington, D.C., Fairfax County, Loudoun County, Peter Strzok on the, not on the stand, but testifying before Congress today, was asked about that one of those texts where he talked about the hillbillies out there in the hinterlands. And he said, Cameron, he was talking about the rivalry between Fairfax County and Loudoun County, Virginia, and referring to the residents of Loudoun County as hillbillies. Mm. Now, for those not in the area, Loudoun County is the wealthiest county per capita in the United States the last time that I checked.
It's also the home of Dulles Airport. When AOL was a big thing, it was the home of the AOL campus. It's the home of the Redskins. There is major money and education and power out there. Just listen, the thing with that testimony today is you can watch that. All it does is just confirm how you believe your side. But at the end of the day, I hope we can all agree, Congress is a disaster. I mean, that hearing, especially in the early part, if you watch the first few minutes of it, everyone's objecting. No one knows if you can object. No one was in control. It was What an absolute disaster. But, yeah, and he also tried to play off how he said this in Southern Virginia, closer to you, how this place stinks of Trump supporters. And he's on the stand trying to say turns of a phrase. I mean, it was very Clintonian. You know, what does a word mean? It was the whole thing.
When I said it stinks of Trump supporters, I just meant, you know, it's like full of Trump supporters.
Right,
haven't you ever heard that phrase? Like, boy, this just stinks of something. But you mean it in a friendly way tonight. It's like it's a good stink, right? It's like, it's not like the stink of old sweat socks. No, it's more of a, is that a homemade chocolate chip cookie stink that I'm smelling here? Oh, that stinks like freedom. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's just been, I'm kind of glad that we're on the air. I suppose that we could duck in. I could try to ask you to find a clean feed, but, at this point, I'm not sure ducking in like this far in. I'm not even sure how it would make sense of it. It'd be like kind of coming in three quarters of the way through a cage match. You know, you're just not, what's happening here?
Yeah.
All right, so we'll leave that. If anything extra crazy breaks out, Cameron, I was going to say crazy, but we've already surpassed that. If anything, if it's up to about 11 now, if it gets up to about a 14, let me know there, and we will break in. Meanwhile, news out of Illinois to tell you about the Illinois News Network reporting. Love this headline, by the way. Growing number of gun sanctuary counties in Illinois sparks concerns. Who's concerned about the growing number of counties in Illinois that are adopting these Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions? Oh, gun control advocates. That's who's concerned. Yeah. As the Illinois News Network reports, the Belleville News Democrat recently reported that 26 of Illinois' 102 counties have some resolution making their jurisdiction a safe haven for law-abiding gun owners. I would note that this story from the Belleville News Democrat, that was last week. That was 4th of July. 26 Illinois counties have passed gun sanctuary resolutions. Are they constitutional? That was the question that the Belleville News Democrat was asking last week. As the Illinois News Network says, the efforts resemble so-called sanctuary cities, where officials vote on resolutions urging local law enforcement not to comply with federal immigration laws. For gun sanctuary counties in Illinois, the resolutions urge local law enforcement not to enforce state or federal gun control measures, which is, by the way, first of all, that's not true. That's not true at all. These resolutions, not one of them, now the language of the resolutions may vary from county to county, but not one of them says, hey, in this county, we don't have any gun laws. Not one of them. These resolutions say if the lawmakers at our state capitol pass laws that infringe on the rights of our residents, we are going to direct law enforcement not to enforce those laws within the county. So way different than just urging law enforcement not to enforce state or federal gun control measures. But again, this is a story written with a point of view, a headline talking about these resolutions raising concerns. So we know where the story's coming from. Mark Walls from the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence said his group is reacting. He said, quote, while this is symbolic, quote-unquote, it also sends a message to people that these groups think gun ownership is more important than protecting human life. Well, no, that's not what these resolutions are about at all. I would think if that's what these resolutions were about, there'd be a resolution that says we respect our guns more than we respect human life. And that's not actually what they're saying. Quite the opposite, as a matter of fact. But it is interesting to note that this is where the gun control groups immediately go, because they have nothing else to go on other than to try to claim that people who don't support them care more about their guns than human life. What is the number one reason people give for being a gun owner these days? Self-defense, right? The protection of life. And the gun control groups out there who are, again, trying to rebrand themselves as gun safety groups, they can only say, nuh-uh. If you really cared about human life, you wouldn't have a gun to protect human life. And we've got a great hero of the day for you coming up here in just a few minutes, talking about using a firearm in defense, this time not in self-defense, but in defense of another. But this is literally the best argument that they have right now, is that the people who are carrying guns to protect themselves and the people that they love don't actually love people at all.
They just love their guns. Mm-hmm. The Illinois News Network says, quote, it's just interesting to me. This is Walsh, the head of the Illinois Council Against, Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence, Mark Walsh, said, quote, it's just interesting to me that some of these counties that are dealing with it, the resolution, are the same ones that went incredibly red in an otherwise blue state in a presidential election. Well, I don't know. I don't know what that's supposed to tell us, unless Mark Walsh is trying to claim that these counties are somehow, you know, they're out of step with Illinois. And I think a lot of these counties would probably tell you, yeah, we're probably out of step with what we see coming out of Chicago. We don't feel like we're in step with that. And we're tired of being blamed for the violence in Chicago. We're tired in Effingham County of being blamed for the actions of criminals in Cook County. And we don't think passing another gun control law that's going to be enforced against us, it's probably going to be dropped up in Cook County if you make an arrest. We don't think that that's going to make the people in Chicago any safer. We don't think it's going to make the people in Southern Illinois any safer. And so we are sending this message of, hey, you want to get tough on crime, get tough on crime. But quit trying to crack down on violent criminals by aiming your laws at law-abiding legal gun owners. That's the message. It's not a message that is opposed to the sanctity of human life. It is not a message that says, we have no gun laws in this county. It is anarchy here. That's not it at all. But that's how the gun control advocates have to portray it. Because they can't argue this on the merits. They can't talk about the failures of their laws to make a difference in Chicago. They can't talk about why it is you can put all these laws on the books, and when a repeat violent offender who's already out on bond for a violent crime is able to bond out again and commit another crime, they are silent. Can't say a word about that. All right, that music means we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, hero of the day, deal of the day, our good guy as well, A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart, Kirk Schlichter at Town Hall, and more. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way.
We've got to Terry Shepard, Larry Zanoff from Hollywood Weapons on the Outdoor Channel. So we got brand new episodes of Hollywood Weapons coming up here.
Yeah, we actually just wrapped the second season a couple days ago. Actually, I got here last night. So, yeah, they premiere
February 24th.
February 24th, Outdoor Channel, yep. 7:30, I believe. I think it's a Saturday. It's really funny. If you remember from last year, we really had fun with it. And God bless Outdoor Channel for trusting us, maybe. And really taking it in, I think, a fun way. We really, I mean, look, it's all, the guns are there, the safety's there, all of the stuff that Larry is great at is there, but I get to play even more dress up, which is critical to my happiness. It's true. What are you guys looking at? Don't you judge me. Don't judge me.
I'm judging.
Yeah, yeah, Larry judges.
Larry, you get to judge.
Larry judges all the time.
I'm sorry, you know. It's difficult to hand the gun off to anyone as it is, but to hand it off to him when he's wearing like 6-inch heels and tight leather pants, it really makes me wonder about my life choices.
I really wish that Tootsie had more, you know, shootouts.
Season 3.
Season 3. We do take viewer feedback. So the last episode, which he's referring to, they weren't 6-inch. They were 3. Mm-hmm. And they were those platform boots that Kate Beckinsale wears. I got to be Kate Beckinsale from Underworld and test, can you actually blow through a floor with bullets when werewolves are chasing you, which is a question I think most people have always wanted answered.
Yeah, I've wondered this myself.
So we aim to please on Outdoor Channel, and we're going to give you that answer. And I got to dress up like her, and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, shows up. We just had a lot of fun.
I think what was really cool, too, is a lot of the viewers kept writing in after season one that they wanted something like from Quigley Down Under. So we listened, and one of the episodes indeed has him dressed up as Quigley Down Under. And
with the mustache.
With the mustache, yeah.
And that's pretty sure that's going to be the premiere
opening
episode.
Season. Yeah,
the premiere is going to be that. And on that note, too, we've really, you know, it's Hollywood Weapons. Larry and I like to think we're cool, but no one really cares about he and I. But We got to interview Tom Selleck. He was a big part of the show.
That's big.
Yeah, because it's Hollywood Weapons. And Gary Sinise was gracious. Nick Searcy from Justified. Daniel Henney, the new guy from Criminal Minds, super nice guy. We've had a lot of good people come in, and I think that adds to it because you're talking to the guys, the actors who were in that scene or in that show, and that we just give it a go.
Well, it absolutely does add to it. But I will say, and don't let this go to your head, Terry, but, you know, there is good chemistry between you and Larry. That's a big part of the show.
We're friends.
It's fun to watch. You learn something.
Cool, thank you.
But, you know, at the end of the day, when you're sitting down in front of a television set, it's entertainment, and you guys are very entertaining.
Oh, good.
It's coming. I wasn't sure it was coming across.
we thought we're definitely entertaining ourselves.
Yourselves, right, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, Larry and I, when we first met for this, God, it seems like a long time ago, we just knew he was riffing on me, I was riffing on him, and I think they didn't expect it quite that way, and they let us run with it. And look, you know, Larry knows his business, and, you know, we both have the same mind, too. I was a Special Forces guy, just retired about a year plus ago from being a team sergeant, so we in our own ways, we have to plan and conduct and supervise very safe training. In my case, it's training or operations, and for Larry, he's dealing with movies. Now, you know, you deal with guys who don't usually handle guns, right? So how am I different? Go ahead and compliment me.
I'm still judging. So I think the big difference and what's really, really cool about this show is that the Outdoor Channel gave us the opportunity to run in the direction that we wanted to go in.
Yeah.
It started out, we talked about this last year. The pilot is the most boring episode of season one, to be honest with you, because we really didn't find our groove or anything. But then afterwards, instead of just having the writer write the script for us, they kind of let us run with it, and they followed the direction we were going.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now. Cam Edwards, your host on the program this hour, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall will join us on the program as well. We also have today's Hero of the Day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. As a matter of fact, let's get to those right now. As a matter of fact, our hero of the day from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Cleveland, Ohio, Evan McDonald reporting. An unidentified teenager tried to take a 79-year-old woman's car at gunpoint on Tuesday in Cleveland's Broadway Slavic Village neighborhood. The woman, thankfully, was unharmed in the attempted carjacking. It happened broad daylight just before 3 p.m. A woman had just arrived home in her brown 2000 Chevy Malibu. So it's not like this was, you know, a Bentley or anything like that. But she pulls up into her driveway when the teenager, who appears to be around 17 years of age, opened her door, pointed a gun at the woman, and said, "Get out, I'm taking your car." Woman's grandson was at home and saw the attempted carjacking through a window. The grandson grabbed his own gun, ran outside, and told the teen to leave his grandmother alone, according to the police report. The armed grandson was enough to convince that teenager he had somewhere else he desperately needed to be. And according to police, he ran away, several other males following him, according to what the grandson told police. No arrests have been made, but the 79-year-old woman is unharmed, thanks to the actions of her armed grandson. And he is today's hero of the day. On to our deal of the day. From the Great Falls Tribune, now this is a confusing story. I'll be honest with you. The headline in Great Falls, Montana, a woman involved in shooting attempted to obtain a protection order against the victim back in June. So there's a guy Monday night who was shot in Great Falls. His name is Jeremiah Walker. He was shot in the parking lot of the 2J's Fresh Market just before 11 p.m. Monday. Two individuals have been arrested in connection with the shooting. They've not been charged with the shooting. 27-year-old Philip McClendon was arrested on probation violations, along with Brianna Lee White, who's 26. Both arrested on probation violations, have not been charged with the shooting, although Brianna White was the one who apparently shot this guy, Jeremiah Walker. Jeremiah Walker's our deal of the day. I don't know what's going to happen with this case, and I have a feeling we don't know all of the details regarding this particular shooting, but Mr. Walker's criminal history is quite fascinating. He actually was the subject of a restraining order petition filed by Breonna Lee White back in June when he was reportedly abusive and exhibiting stalking behavior, but she withdrew that request for the restraining order on June 21st. Looks like the judge was ready to grant the order, but she apparently declined to pursue it. Walker, since 1999, has been convicted of stalking, aggravated kidnapping, assault with a weapon, as well as burglary, all in the last 20 years. In 2000, he was charged with sexual intercourse without consent, along with the kidnapping and domestic assault charge, but the rape charge was dropped in a plea bargain. That's right. In 2013, he was arrested on his second stalking charge after an ex-girlfriend reported to police that he was calling her 20 times a day, would show up at her friends' homes, leave flowers on her car. She told police, according to court documents, this has gone on for 2 months before she ended up reporting him. He was arrested. He was charged later that year, 5 years ago. Prosecutors requested the judge dismiss the case, writing in the motion that upon further investigation, the state is unable to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So he was arrested, he was charged, but ultimately not prosecuted for stalking 5 years ago. Last month, this woman, Breonna White, files a petition for a restraining order against Walker, claiming that he stalked her, dragged her by her hair, and abused her. On one occasion, according to petition, he said, I should have just bought a gun. Not clear why the restraining order request was withdrawn, but Mr. Walker here, who was not killed, he is in a local hospital and is the victim, considered the victim in this particular case, at least what police are reporting right now. As it turns out, quite the lengthy criminal history, including some chances to put him behind bars for a pretty significant amount of time that were dropped in a plea bargain, and he is today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day, from Charlotte, North Carolina, Fox 46, the officer of the month there in Charlotte, named just a couple of days ago, Officer Tony McDaniel. He is stationed at the Charlotte Douglas International Airport. And the, I guess this was last month, there was a, that's Officer McDaniel behind me. He got a frantic phone call from a woman who had put her mom on a plane. And the plane was flying from Denver to Charlotte. And then her mom had to make a connection, or actually was flying from, Denver to Charlotte, had a connection in Charlotte, and then her mom was going on to Atlanta. Her mom suffers from dementia, has Alzheimer's. And this woman had told the airline what's going on, said, you know, you need to keep an eye on her. But she said there's so much that people need to know about Alzheimer's because they think you can tell her something and 10 minutes later she'll remember. So they probably told her to stay at the gate. But telling her is just like telling a kid who can't comprehend it. She'll still wander off if you're not right there to guide her. So her mom never made that connecting flight. And she got a call saying that your mom never made the connecting flight. So this woman is, you know, hundreds of miles away in Colorado. And she's getting ready to hop on an airplane to Charlotte to try to find her mom, who is, she hopes, still there in the airport. She called the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, got connected to Officer McDaniel. Officer McDaniel said she was frantic. Yeah, she was upset. She was assuming the worst. Thankfully, Officer McDaniel was able to find this woman's mom in about 15 minutes. Sandra, who's the woman's daughter, said he called me back and said, I found your mom and she's fine. Calm down and you don't have to get on a flight, which was nice. And the story could have ended there. But it's actually what happened next that makes Officer McDaniel our good guy today. He did not leave that woman's side. He got her something to eat, got her something to drink. He got the airline to book her on the next flight to Atlanta. He waited with her at the gate. He even got on the plane with her and actually told the other passengers, hey, here's what's going on. Can you all just kind of keep an eye on her? Sandra said it made me cry. She said, I get emotional talking about it because he was so kind-hearted. He said that if this had happened to my mom, I would want something to do the same thing. And Officer McDaniel actually told Fox 46 in Charlotte that his mom actually suffers from vascular dementia. He said, so I know how to deal with her. I know how to talk with her. He said, I guess I took a personal interest in this lady. So there you go. If you are flying through Charlotte, North Carolina, and you see Officer Tony McDaniel, give him a shout out. Give him a pat on the back. Thank him for being one of the many, many good guys out there. And today's good guy, as always, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher. And we've still got Dr. AWR Hawkins joining us here in just a few minutes. Also, Kurt Schlichter will be with us from Town Hall. His latest, liberals super sad, he says, about the Supreme Court. And he thinks that is a wonderful development. Now, interestingly enough, over at Hot Air, John Sexton has the story, Senate Democratic leadership, there's really not much we can do to stop Kavanaugh. Yeah, it's hard to believe. It was just a few days ago. You had Chuck Schumer coming out Monday night. I will oppose the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh with everything I have. You got nothing, Chuck. You got nothing. I mean, you have your outrage, but I'm not even sure you have every Democrat on board here. According to the latest reporting from Washington, D.C., and this is from The Hill. Senate Democratic leaders this week appear to try to tamp down expectations of the party's progressive base, with Minority Leader Charles Schumer saying the procedural options for Democrats are, quote, not that large. Schumer told reporters during a weekly press conference when asked about the possibility of actions like boycotting a confirmation hearing, quote, there's no way we can prevent the Senate from meeting. There's been some discussion about that, but it just wouldn't happen. So that was actually something that the base has been calling for. You got to stop this nomination. You got to stop it. You got to stop it. Anything you can do, you got to stop it. And one way to stop it, they say, is just don't show up. If all of the Democrats stay away, and John McCain's out in Arizona, and the Republicans only have 50 Republicans, they don't have enough for a quorum, the Senate can't do any business. We can stop it. Just stay away. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer, who's thinking not just about this confirmation, but he's also thinking about the elections, is thinking to himself, how many seats do you want Republicans to have come November? We just stay away? We just don't show up? We just don't do anything? How many seats are we defending right now? How many is it conceivably possible that we could lose in November? You want to hand them a 60-vote supermajority there in the Senate? Okay, we'll just stay away. We just won't show up. That'll play very well back home in a lot of these battleground districts. Senator Dick Durbin said, quote, some of the things that have been in blogs and suggested do not even understand the basics of the Senate. Some of the people who have come up to me at parades and said, shut them down, do this, do that. It reflects a limited understanding of how the Senate operates. Now, this is Dick Durbin talking about the Democratic base, by the way. They don't understand how the Senate works. No, they don't, Dick. They don't. They don't, and frankly, you've got some colleagues that are getting ready to join you in Congress that don't really understand how economics works either. I mean, that's troubling, too. Hey, Cameron, question. We've had public education for how long in this country? Long time.
100 plus years?
Yeah. I'm just curious. Whose fault is it if the American people who go to public schools from kindergarten through 12th grade, whose fault is it if we don't know how the Senate works?
Well, for the pithy answer is go to any educational union's Twitter feed or website and see what they're talking about. They hardly talk about education. It's a mishmash of every leftist thing out there. Education doesn't seem to be their top priority, sadly. And this is what happens.
No, it does not. Yeah. John Sexton points out at Hot Air as well that Adam Gentleson, the former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, has a piece in the Washington Post today with his four-part playbook on how to stop the Kavanaugh nomination. How to stop it. Step one, keep all the Democrats together, which is going to be tough. You know, you had Patrick Morrissey, who's the Republican candidate for Senate in West Virginia. He came out earlier this week and said, I think Joe Manchin's going to end up voting for Kavanaugh. I think he has to. if he wants any chance of keeping his job in November. This is the guy who's running against Joe Manchin, saying, I think he has to vote for the guy, or he's toast. I'll clobber him. So you've got the Republican candidate in West Virginia saying, I think Manchin's going to go for it. Manchin actually offering up some very nice words about Brett Kavanaugh today. So there are already signs that some of these endangered red state Democrats, and there was another poll out showing Claire McCaskill actually now behind in Missouri in her race to keep her Senate seat. There's some cracks already emerging here in that a Democratic caucus. But that's step one, keep all the Democrats together. Step two, put pressure on Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who are also, they haven't come right out and said they're going to support Brett Kavanaugh, but they have sounded optimistic, haven't expressed any immediate reservations of, well, now this is a deal breaker. Step three, Adam Gentleson says, is to publicly scrutinize Kavanaugh's opinions. They'll get around to that. Right now, they're chastising him for liking baseball and for being named Brett. That's where they're going right now. You saw this story, right, that came out last night. Chris Saliza, Brett Kavanaugh, call your office. And the story was Brett Kavanaugh, there was like 1 year where Brett Kavanaugh reported a large number of debt on his credit cards, in part because he bought season tickets to the Washington Nationals for himself and some friends, and he put it on his credit card, and then his friends paid him back for the season tickets that he bought. To which I say, Cameron, why isn't that a disqualification, automatic disqualification for the Supreme Court?
The only thing that would have made that better is if he went into debt buying Uncle Sam costumes.
I seriously.
Give me a break. Call your office, Chris. Yeah.
I understand. We just got word Brett Kavanaugh bought his mom an apple pie with a credit card. Can you believe that? Baseball, mom, and apple pie. That actually probably would be a disqualifying factor for several senators. I'm sorry, you've hit the trifecta of Americanism. That just means you're a nationalist and we can't support you anymore. Step four for Adam Gentleson, the former deputy chief of staff for Harry Reid. He says, quote, Democrats should force the issue by using the substantial power of the minority to grind the Senate to a halt and scuttle other Republican priorities, including funding the government when the current fiscal year ends September the 30th. He goes on to say, to be clear, denying consent is an effective tactic for delay, but it's not a path to blocking Kavanaugh. If the GOP has 51 votes, the procedural delays can be overcome and Kavanaugh will be confirmed. So in other words, make it grind to a halt, but that won't actually stop it. As long as they've got 51 votes, you can delay it, you can grind it down, but it's not going to stop the vote. Again, they will do everything that they can to try to stop this vote. That's why I encourage you, no matter where you live, no matter who your senators are, contact them. Make sure that they know where you stand on this confirmation vote. And again, if you're in a deep blue state like California, or live in a red state like Texas, or anywhere in between, make sure your senators are hearing from you. They need to hear from you on stuff like this. But, I don't think there are a lot of options open for Chuck Schumer. And honestly, this idea of, you know, grinding the Senate to a halt, doing everything that they can to obstruct the a confirmation vote, when particularly we've seen polling out of these states where Democrats are up for re-election, but Donald Trump won those states back in 2016, the support for confirmation is really strong. I mean, you're asking these senators, again, to go against the wishes of their constituents in the months before an election. But the people who are making those recommendations don't live in Montana or North Dakota or West Virginia or Missouri or Indiana. They live inside the Beltway, or they live in New York City, or they live in the Bay Area, and they don't know anybody in these red states. They don't know any of these voters. So it sounds like a great idea, because they're thinking about how do you keep our base motivated? How do you keep the resistance energized? And if you roll over, if you allow this vote, then the resistance, well that's going to demotivate them. And maybe they don't show up. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez probably still going to win election in New York, but what about these Democratic Socialist candidates that are running for state legislature in Pennsylvania? Are they going to get hurt? Are these more progressive candidates going to get hurt by their base staying home because their base has been disappointed by Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin and the rest of the Democratic Party leadership? I mean, that's the conundrum right now for the Democrat Party. Appeasing or trying to appease an increasingly irrational base while at the same time trying to bring in independent voters. Because, again, that base is not enough to win you elections across the country. That base is not going to win you Montana. That base isn't going to win you Missouri or Indiana or North Dakota. May get you, you know, you may win a primary, but it's not going to get you 50 plus one in a statewide election. And so this is the dance that they'll be doing from July through November, trying to keep those big city, coastal progressives happy and satisfied while trying not to repel independent voters and Democrats in middle America. It's going to be a heck of a dance to watch them try to do here for the next few months. All right, when we come back, Anna-Maria Hawkins of Breitbart News will be with us later in the hour. Our friend Kurt Schlichter joins us as well. Stick around. We have much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children and freedom's safest place.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and then when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carry, carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can
always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of a scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience, and I think it's great for someone that's coming in, and this may be the only class they take.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Thank you so much for tuning in to NRA TV or watching us on Amazon or Apple TV or listening on iTunes, iHeartRadio, however you found us. We're glad that you're here. Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall is going to join us in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Breitbart News, our friend Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins is with us. Dr. Hawkins, good afternoon to you, sir.
Oh, thank you, Cam. Great to be with you, buddy.
It is good to have you with us today. I appreciate you joining us. And let's talk about this. I'm so glad to see that you're writing about what's going on in New York 21, where Tedra Cobb, the Democrat running for Congress there, says when she thinks nobody's listening that she supports banning guns. But she can't say that publicly, Dr. Hawkins, because she says if she did so, she would lose the election. And not only is she saying this, but she says a Moms Demand Action volunteer actually told her not to talk about her support for gun bans because she would lose the election.
Right, which is really weird because Moms Demand has been telling us for years that the support for gun control is through the roof and that the NRA is standing in the way. So it's really weird that suddenly voicing support for gun control means you can't get elected. But you're exactly right, and she wants to ban assault rifles. She says she's for it. Doesn't mince words, as you say, when she doesn't know she's being recorded. But she says she can't say that in front of her constituents because they won't elect her.
Yeah, now it's interesting to note that so Tedra Cobb, the Democrat candidate, caught on tape saying I'm not honest with voters because I wouldn't win the election. And Moms Demand Action says, you know, I shouldn't talk about this. Well, Moms Demand Action came out and they're now accusing her of being a liar. Dr. Hawkins, they're now saying we never told Tedra Cobb not to talk about a gun ban. We want candidates to be honest about supporting a wide variety of gun control laws. So they're now calling her a liar, too.
Right. Well, you know what? The Moms Demand Action, I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm just saying, you know, that's a funny little group because they've never had to win. They don't win. But it doesn't matter because they have Mike Bloomberg's wallet behind them. So they kind of make their own rules as they go along. So
yeah,
the infighting doesn't surprise me. You know, with Shannon Watts, Shannon Watts is capable of saying anything at any time. And then she'll act like she never said it if it doesn't benefit her. And she doesn't have to answer for those things because, again, Mike Bloomberg's wallet is behind her. So I'm not shocked that they would come out after her, and we'll never know who's telling the truth between Cobb and Moms Demand. But the thing that voters in New York 21 need to know, no matter what, we know now that she supports an assault rifle ban, and that's the thing they must vote against.
Absolutely, no, you're absolutely right. I do find it interesting, and I'm with you. I have no look. I wasn't there. I don't know who said what to whom, but I find it interesting that when Moms Demand Action's asked about this, so did you really tell her not to support this gun ban? They didn't say, hell no. In fact, we're going to tell her now. We want you to support a gun ban. What they said, Dr. Hawkins, was really interesting. They said, well, no, we didn't say that. We encourage our candidates to be honest about a wide variety of gun controls or a wide variety of gun safety regulations that they support. But they didn't actually ask her to support a gun ban.
Which is weird because we know that nationally that's absolutely something that these moms demand action and support. They support banning commonly owned semi-automatic firearms. So why would they not then take this opportunity to ask one of their endorsed candidates to clarify where she stands on a semi-auto ban?
Unless they think she's such damaged goods that she can't get elected.
Well,
I'm just saying, you know, they're opportunists and they're pragmatic. And so that could be it. But, you know, I always point out with Moms Demand Action, don't ever forget, they're for taking our guns, but their leadership, including Shannon Watts, is surrounded by armed men at all times. And it's important to remember that. They believe that a good guy with a gun is the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun. They just don't want us to have those good guys. And that's a problem for me because it's hypocritical.
To say the least, absolutely. And frankly, you know, to me, this is more evidence, Dr. Hawkins, that these gun control advocates, they're going to say what they feel like they have to say to get elected. And once they're in office, then they're going to do what they want to do. And it's sad that they feel like that's the only way to advance their agenda is to actually lie about what it is that they want to do. Because if you talk to people who are Second Amendment supporters, they'll be honest with you about what it is that they want. They want to ensure that our individual right to keep and bear arms is able to be exercised by law-abiding Americans from coast to coast. It's pretty simple. We don't have to lie about what we want.
But the thing is, as I made the point earlier, all the polls they cite that show strong support for gun control, they never reveal what segment of the country or what region is being polled at that time. And the thing is, they know that the support for gun control is not there. It's just not. And this candidate's behavior is proof of that. And it's also why the NRA has stood their ground as they have. It's why Breitbart has stood its ground as it has. Because we know, and you know, and the NRA knows, that the commoner, the average Joe, the salt of the earth American, does not want his or her firearms regulated, taken away, the size of their magazines reduced. They do not want that. Just because one criminal acts like a criminal, we shouldn't punish the law-abiding citizen. And the average American understands that.
Absolutely. And the average American, frankly, is seeing, unfortunately, a lot of these politicians make them feel like they are second fiddle. Look, you're an American citizen, but you're not as important as somebody who's trying to enter this country illegally. Look, you're a legal gun owner, but the way to address violent crime is to go after you instead of the gang members. We're going to be talking with Kurt Schlichter coming up a little bit later on in the hour. He's got a book coming out later this year called Militant Normals. And I think this phenomenon that he's describing, Dr. Hawkins, is real. If you're just an average Joe American, you don't want to care about politics 24 hours a day. You don't want this to be your life. You are now forced to care. When Michelle Obama said, you'll be made to care. All right. We've been made to care because a lot of us who don't want to get in other people's faces. We don't want to try to tell other people how to live their lives. But we'll be damned if we're going to just sit here and let others dictate what we do from the time we wake up in the morning until the time we put our head on the pillow at night.
Right. Well, not only that, Cam, but I don't think I'm going to sit in a restaurant and let overweight women or men come and stand over me and spit on me while I eat dinner or scream at me like they screamed at the Florida AG or at Sarah Sanders or whoever it is or at Scott Pruitt. And I think the left has created an environment that makes us clean. And I know Obama loved to make fun of us. We're bitter cleaners. I don't care what he thought. It makes us cling even more to our guns and to our ability to defend ourselves. And, the left is creating an environment where gun ownership and the ability to be independent is something that Americans have learned to treasure all over again. And it's just funny. They don't see what they're doing, but what they're actually doing is they are inviting regular Americans to take up arms and not take up arms against government, things like that, but just to be armed for their own safety. And it's the environment that the left has created, not that the right has created.
Well, you know, and to that end, I mean, it's interesting. We were talking about this a little bit on yesterday's program. You know, there's this attitude. So, and you wrote about this down in Florida, this manager at Academy Sports who saw a guy try to steal a handgun, ran over and tackled this guy. Held him along with one of his employees until police got there, and they took this guy into custody and had stolen a gun. He had stolen some magazines, had some ammunition, actually stolen two other guns from a pawn shop a couple of hours earlier. And then this manager gets fired by Academy, right? Because apparently he put his hands on this guy and violated corporate policy. And I'm, yeah, I haven't heard it. Again, I have not heard any gun control advocates complain about this guy getting fired. Their attitude is, don't get involved. Their attitude is, you know, if you see something, say something, but you don't need a gun for self-defense. You certainly don't need to try to stand in the way of a somebody who's stealing a gun or to try to get involved when someone's trying to conduct an armed robbery. So we're told to leave this all to the professionals. At the same time, Dr. Hawkins, they're attacking the professionals. I mean, they're going right. after law enforcement. Every day they're bashing law enforcement, whether it's, right. you know, ICE, whether it's Customs and Border Patrol, whether it's law enforcement, you know, working the streets of Baltimore or St. Louis or Chicago, Illinois. They don't want us to be able to protect them ourselves. And then they go after those institutions that they say we should rely upon for our protection.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is very anecdotal, but I have a friend who I went through when I was doing my PhD, who was doing his master's degree in at Tech, and he is now an ICE agent. We talk regularly, and he's worked in two cities, and he gets no praise for what he does. He doesn't drive a marked car. His life is regularly at risk, and he is one of the greatest dudes that ever walked this earth. He doesn't ask for anybody to praise him, recognize him, thank him, anything. He does that job every day. And when I hear these people on the left trash ICE the way they do, my blood boils because, you know, and I know you're the same way I am, Cam. I've got friends in Secret Service, FBI, across the board, all these friends, and they're all the same. They live this life without uniforms that set them apart. And they don't get praised because no one even knows what they do. And when the left trashes law enforcement like that, it makes my blood boil. That's all I can say.
Amen. Dr. Hawkins, listen, we've got to take a time out, but thank you as always, sir, for coming on the program. It was great talking with you today.
Great talking to you. Look, tell Kurt, Kurt is a live wire, and I love him.
I will pass that message along, buddy. Hey, man, thank you so much.
Thank you, buddy. Have a good day.
You too. Kurt Schlichter is going to come up with us here in a matter of moments. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joining us from Breitbart. This question posed by Slate this afternoon. My niece wears her Make America Great hat to family parties. What should I do? What should I do? My advice from dear Cam, get over yourself and love your niece. That seems pretty simple. Cameron, I need an advice column at Slate.
You sure? You get some wacky questions.
Wait, would it be Salon or Slate? I don't know. Yeah. I would do it for a week. No.
Maybe a day.
No, I would be out at Vox. There's no way. There's no way any of these organizations would ever hire me in the first place.
Yeah,
so it's, you know, all a moot point. But, yeah, my niece wears a MAGA hat to family parties. What should I do? I guess you've got a couple of choices. You can not go to the parties if it offends you that much. You can, again, not be bothered by the fact that a family member has a different political opinion than you do. You can try to engage your niece in an actual conversation about politics as opposed to just immediately freaking out because of the hat that she's got on. I mean, there are several things that you could do. It's kind of sad that you got to write to a website to try to figure all that stuff out, but there you go. All right, when we return, our friend Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall, who could also use an advice column, I think. I would read Dear Kurt. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this. Cameron Gray, by the way, to chastise here, Cameron, because you kept me up late last night, obliquely, because you tweeted out something about this bookstore, Haymarket Books, which is at I guess it's like a pop-up bookstore at a socialism conference. And what was your tweet?
They said there's this conference in Chicago, and I guess they're a title sponsor of it, and that they said, here, our bookstore is open. And I said, so all those books are free, right? I didn't get a response, of course.
Ha ha, very funny capitalist pig. So I saw this tweet from Cameron, and I ended up going down this socialist rabbit hole.
Dude, I did too.
Holy moly.
That's I'll retweet it at Cam and Company so people can play along. But it's the hashtag is socialism 2018. Yeah. It's really mind blowing. I had the same problem. I could not go to bed. It's just every time you saw a tweet, you kept following their timeline.
Yeah.
Oh my God, these people.
Finally, somebody like tweeted at me at like 12:45. Like, hey, it's almost 1 o'clock. Shouldn't even go into bed. I'm like, all right, thank you, Twitter stranger. As I'm going through some of these tweets, the one that got me, and I'm like, okay, you know, I'm not gonna, I don't want to pick on somebody who's got like 14 followers. I don't want to, you know, highlight that and just, everybody, you know, attack. But there was one tweet that just absolutely blew my mind, floored me, from someone, Socialist Angel. okay. So much for, I guess, religion being the opiate of the masses there. I don't know. Socialist_Angel. In the last 100 years, the advancement of technology has done little to improve people's lives versus what it has done to advance the ability of capitalist bosses to make money. And I read this and I just thought to myself, that can't be serious. Can it? I mean, think about the world in 1918 for a second. Okay, so first of all, the Spanish flu was raging. Actually, was getting ready to erupt in the summer of 1918. And by the end of the year, across the world, about 20 million people would die. In the United States, the estimates are 500,000 to 675,000 Americans would die. The life expectancy in the United States dropped by 12 years in 1918 just because of the Spanish flu. You didn't have any treatment whatsoever. There was no flu vaccine. So right there, Cameron, I'm going to give a big check mark to 2018. Then you just think about something as simple and something that I'm sure that Socialist Angel takes for granted. Central heating and air, right? Just think about that for a second. We complain, right? Oh, God, we go outside and it's so hot, so muggy outside. All I want to do is just sit in front of my air conditioner. I just want to sit under my ceiling fan and just open up my refrigerator and just, oh, yeah, just stick my head in the ice box. Guess what you couldn't do 100 years ago? Any of that. It would, oh, it's so hot inside. I'm going to go inside. Oh, God, it's just as warm and muggy inside, too. Oh, I wish somebody would invent this magic box where cold air would just come out of it. Oh, man, that'd be amazing. I'd be the happiest person in the world. Can you imagine how much better our quality of life would be if there was just this magic box that cold air would come out of? And if they could look into the future, they would tell Socialist Angel, what are you complaining about? What are you talking about? Technology hasn't benefited the working class. How about the widespread availability of the automobile? I mean, how about that in terms of giving the working class freedom and mobility? I mean, like, you could, seriously, you could go on and on. And you could, look, I'm happy to have the discussion about technology that freaks me out, like the robot dogs that can open doors and stuff. I can have that conversation too. But that's a different conversation than over the past 100 years. All this technology has just gone to, you know, the rich capitalist bosses. Did I miss the memo, Cameron? Is it only the 1% that have access to air conditioning?
I guess so.
Do they have better air conditioning that we're not aware of?
The whole thing, you know, you could, like you said, you could go on and on. And most of these tweets are just like, just progressive word salad. Not even progressive, just like, you know, the socialist word salad. My favorite one was, gentrification is localized colonialism. Can't even say it with a straight face.
Wow.
They just tweet this nonsense and hope someone thinks it's a great idea. And my favorite one, I don't know if you saw it, was the guy, I guess he's a movie star or something like that, and they had a picture of him that says, socialism, resist, and everything. And there's a big Starbucks cup right in front of him at the socialism cup. It was such a joy to go through that nonsense all night.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. It is NRA TV. I am Cam Edwards at Cam Edwards on Twitter. And our guest this segment, the one, the only, the author of the upcoming Militant Normals, Mr. Kurt Schlichter is with us, senior columnist at Town Hall. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. So I do want to talk about your column. I want to talk about the Supreme Court. But can we talk about this court case that that you won this week?
Well, look, as much as I would like to blow my own horn, I was simply one of a team of lawyers here at my firm and at the Gober Group in Texas that helped Ben Shapiro beat the young man and his father known as Clock Boy. And we beat them in the trial court. We got their case where they accused Ben Shapiro, the Ben Shapiro, of defaming them on Fox News. And we won it at the trial court level. It was thrown out. And then the Texas Court of Appeal yesterday affirmed the dismissal of the case. We won. Free speech.
That is fantastic. Congratulations. Now, could they appeal this up to, like, the Texas State Supreme Court?
Well, they can petition for review because you can always appeal a case to the first appellate court. They have to take in considerate. Supreme Courts tend to only take cases that they find are particularly unusual or where there's a dispute in the lower courts. And this one was right on point. It's very clear that when you're a public figure like Clock Boy was, I mean, he's tweeting back and forth with the president, you have to show actual malice, that is knowing falsehood or reckless disregard of the truth, before you can pursue a defamation claim, libel, slander. And he simply couldn't do that. Court of Appeals said, no, you just can't do that. You're allowed to state your opinions. And, you know, and if you don't like the opinions, free speech, your free speech is your route, not taking somebody to court and trying to run up their legal bills and stuff. That's not the way to do it.
Okay, speaking of legal bills, did I read this story correctly that the Court of Appeals said that Clock Boy's family will be paying the legal fees for your client?
Yeah, on a anti-SLAPP motion, strategic lawsuit against public participation. It's basically a special procedure to throw out free speech cases early, and we have them in many states, not enough in my opinion, because I think it's very important. The losing plaintiff, somebody who's suing to essentially punish somebody for exercising free speech, has to pay the legal fees. So we've already received a partial fee award against the family. We're going to probably ask for more. And the other guys, Jim Hansen, Sarah for Security Policy, they've got the same.
Will you be buying perhaps a grandfather clock with part of the proceeds of the legal fees? Will there be some sort of – will you get a Rolex? I mean, Kurt, you got to celebrate with some sort of timepiece here.
I can't promise that, but I will buy you a drink when I come to Washington on my book tour for Sweet Talk.
All right. That's a deal. So let's talk about the book for just a second, because the other day our mutual friend Terry Shepard had tweeted out something about, you know, the left keeps calling me a dangerous, and all I want to do is I just want to live my life. I just want to, you know, be normal. I just want to do normal things. But they keep talking about how dangerous I am. Fine, I'm dangerous. To which I respond, I think the term is militant normal. I mean, you know, it's interesting, Kurt, when you had this idea for this book and you started writing, obviously you didn't know exactly where this country would be when the book comes out. And it's not coming out until October. But it's become clear to me that one of the themes, one of the cultural themes of this election year is going to be, am I allowed to be normal? Am I allowed to be myself? Am I allowed to just exist in my world and go to church on Sunday and go to my job on Monday and come home and watch football or hang out with my kids and play with my dog? Can I do all of these things? Or am I going to live in a country where every single decision I make is going to be second-guessed by people who have never met me, who are going to try to use the decisions that I make to try to portray me as a bigot, as a racist, as a homophobe, as a Nazi, as an enemy of the state? And what is our country going to look like? I mean, that actually is a defining question, I think, for these midterm elections.
I think it is. I mean, look what's happening to Brett Kavanaugh, right? I mean, he's getting grief for having, you know, this militantly normal family, right? You know, everybody knows their gender. Everybody, no weird piercings. I mean, they just like look like, you know, something out of 50s television. And he's getting grief for that. He's getting grief because he bought baseball tickets and because he used to be in a frat and because his name's Brett. I mean, You know, it's not live and let live. It's live and let's go hassle people and force them to live our way. I don't see folks like you or me going out of our way to mess with anybody. I don't think Terry Shepard cares what people, you know, if somebody wants to dress like a cartoon fox and walk around saying, I'm a furry, I don't think Terry's really going to care. But, you know, the guy dressed like a fox is probably going to give us grief because we're not. And that's annoying, and that's why people get militant.
So I'm curious. I mean, we've seen this, obviously, as you described, like, you know, the Trump officials or even former workers in the Trump administration yelled at as they eat dinner. You know, again, there should be no peace for these individuals. I don't see them changing strategy between now and November. In fact, you know, there's a fascinating story about the election of Brett Kavanaugh, or the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, and Dick Durbin getting a little testy. He was asked by reporters about this yesterday. You know, what are you guys going to do to stop this? And he said, you know, I'm being approached by people at like parades and stuff, and the stuff that they're suggesting just doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, don't show up for work. Well, we can't really do that. And he says there are a lot of these people. He's talking about his base. He said there are a lot of these people who don't understand the basic functions of the Senate, the basic rules of the Senate. And that's who Dick Durbin needs to get out and vote in November. These people who don't, and not only do they not understand how the Senate works, they don't care how the Senate works. They don't want to see Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. And if he's on the Supreme Court, they're going to blame Dick Durbin. They're going to blame Chuck Schumer. It doesn't matter what the rules of the Senate are. How do you try to appease that base while at the same time engaging in voter outreach, trying to grow your party, trying to bring people in from the outside when your party is engaged in a purity contest at the moment? And anybody who doesn't, you know, match up 100% with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez deserves to be sent to the rhetorical, at this point, rhetorical gulag.
The rhetorical gulag. Well, let's face it. The Democrats have a problem because a key constituency within the Democrat coalition is half-wits. All right? They have a monopoly on people who are stupid. And in fact, when they start screaming about, all these people were tricked into the Russians by the Russians to vote for Trump and not for Hillary. I guess what you're saying is you expected all the idiots to vote your way. I just don't think they make up a huge part of the American people. I think normal Americans have pretty good instincts. I think they know what's good for them. They know what's good for their family. And, you know, Cam, they know when somebody's hassling them. I mean, if you were to go into Farmville and go into a bar and you saw some little guy with a goatee coming up and start poking at one of the farmer guy's going to go, leave me alone, leave me alone, leave me alone. And if he doesn't, you know, homeboy's going to get a fist in the face. You know, these folks don't seem to realize the nature of the American people. They really don't seem to understand anyone outside their little bubble. And it's funny because these are people always babbling about multiculturalism and diversity, but they hate that. They want everybody to be just like them. But you and I and folks like us, I don't care what they do on Friday night in West Hollywood. It doesn't matter to me. But it matters greatly to them what I do Sunday morning.
Absolutely. Talking with our friend Curtis Lichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, his latest, liberals are super sad about the Supreme Court. Good, says Kurt. And as you say, the attacks so far, Kurt, seem to be, can you believe this guy's name is Brett? I can't believe this guy bought baseball
tickets. It's not even like a bad name. Here's our next Justice Melvin Poindexter. You know, I mean, it's not, Brett, when did that become like a bad name? That's just kind of a bro name, you know? I guess it's way too cis-het.
That's the thing. I mean, Narol called him, you know, frat boy Brett in one of their tweets. So, you know, again, if this is what they've got, Kurt, great.
It's such a bad strategy.
Again, what they're doing is they're attacking Americans. They're attacking a guy for his name. This is the party of tolerance. This is the party of acceptance, the party of love and togetherness. And they're going after somebody because they don't like his name.
Look, what they're really doing is they're kind of just being obnoxious and waking up the sleeping giant. It happened when I was at UC San Diego. I was among a bunch of little activist conservatives, and we wanted to take over the student council. So I wasn't a member of any fraternity, but I went to the fraternity guys, and we got them on our side because they were sick of being picked on. So all of a sudden, all these frat boys and I guess frat girls, showed up and voted in the student government election, and we took over the government. And the liberals were like stunned. And they're like, well, I can't believe it. I call them names. We abuse them. We hassle them. We inflict these little petty indignities upon them. And they reacted. I'm shocked. And that's what they're doing. You know, I mean, they're not smart enough to let sleeping dudes lie.
No, they're not. And, you know, at this point, I mean, there's really not much I think that the Democrats can do to try to stop this nomination. But if so Kurt, if Brett Kavanaugh gets confirmed, how bad does that hurt the Democratic base heading into November?
I think they'll be demoralized. I think, you know, I don't think they can get any angrier. You know, when it's already up to 11, there's not a lot of room to go on the little volume meter. So I'm not particularly concerned about them being more activated. I think they will be actually demoralized. I think a lot of conservatives will be happy and want to preserve this. It's very important that we get out and make our voices heard in November, especially with future seats on the Supreme Court. Look, our First Amendment rights, our Second Amendment rights are at stake. The Democrat Party is against both. And if we don't get the right people on there, you know, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen this play out actually in upstate New York. I've been tweeting about this the last couple of days. New York 21, the Democratic candidate there, Tedrick Cobb, caught on tape telling gun control activists, you know, I was asked the other day, do you support banning assault rifles? And I said, yes, but I can't say that publicly. Well, and the woman said, I wish you wouldn't. She said, well, I can't win an election if I do that. Moms Demand Action said, don't talk about how you want to ban these guns or you won't win an election. You know, at this point, Kurt, it doesn't even matter.
Our party's so awesome, we need to lie about our platform. That seems like a hard sell.
It does. Yeah, it really does. And again, I mean, and she was so kind of blasé and even talking about this, like it didn't even register. Like, isn't there something, there's something wrong, isn't there, when you can't be honest with the voters because they won't vote for you?
Yeah, maybe you should have other policies if you want to represent people. You know, maybe you are not the right person to represent them if you don't believe in the things they do. Am I kooky there, Cam? Is that nuts?
I don't think that's nuts. Nope. I don't think that's nuts, but apparently, you know, she really wants to be in Congress and she can't afford the rent in New York City, so she's got to run an upstate, and that means she just apparently got to, you know, can't be honest about her opinions, where she stands on the issues.
That's the thing about conservatives. We're proud about what we stand for. We don't hide it.
Exactly right. Kurt Schlichter, we got to leave it there, man. I appreciate you joining us on the program. Thank you so much. Enjoy
Thanks
the new grandfather
me.
Clock, and we will talk to you soon. We will talk to you tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on NRA TV. Full lineup, great show straight ahead. Thanks for tuning in today.